The time is 8:31, and I'd like to go ahead and call the application review committee meeting to order. Miss Folks, would you like to do the roll call, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Malott?
Here.
Dr. Catarino?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. I'd like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting minutes for April 2nd, 2021.
I second that motion.
It would be a first. I was asking for a motion.
Oh, I would like to make the motion, I'm sorry, to approve the minutes of April 21, 2021.
I'll go ahead and second it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. I'd like to also, I'll go ahead and make this motion to approve the minutes of the executive session, also on the same date. Do I hear a second?
Yes, I second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Meeting minutes approved, both the regular and the executive session. I'd like to go ahead and make a motion to adjourn the meeting. Do I hear a second?
A second.
Move to approve the minutes. Do I hear a motion to approve? Do I hear an approval?
Yes, I approve.
Approved. Meeting. We are adjourned. Thank you. The meeting concludes at 8:32 a.m. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome a lot. I think we have everybody for the full board meeting. So we can get started there as well. The time is now 8:33 a.m. on June 4th, 2021, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Poe, would you please do a roll call?
Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Ms. LaBoy?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Please note that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend a discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to the former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. The board does encourage everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the survey link on the meeting agenda that is posted to the board's website. I do want to take a moment to recognize all board members for your hard work. We know that each board member spends many hours preparing for each meeting, and we do greatly appreciate your time and your effort. I would also like to acknowledge the efforts of the board staff and our attorney. We are still seeing an unprecedented number of applications and other issues come forth to the board and other discussion points, and they have worked diligently to make sure that the workload is eased for us. We get a packet of information that is very well organized, very thorough. They send a lot of great communication and preparation for the meeting, and all of that is greatly appreciated. Attendance of this board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit. To receive credit, listen to the code words provided throughout the meeting and email those words to board staff within 1 week of the meeting. We will now move to the call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any board complaint matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. Those wishing to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I will call on you.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
HB, yes. Please do address the board.
Really quick, your agenda online, the published agenda said 5 minutes, and so I planned for that. Is that okay? I don't know where I would cut. So
yes, I would be okay with that.
Okay, thank you so much. Good morning, board members, staff, and Ms. Galvin. I'm here because the way you handled my agenda item last month left more questions than answers, and especially because it relates to my own rights and protection as a healthcare privacy, I had to come back. To just paraphrase real quick, a while back, I reported psychologist A. Some inaccurate things about me and my clinical presentation were discussed at the CSC for that, so I thought that a testing psychologist to evaluate me and write and submit a report to demonstrate these things were untrue so I could get my dignity and credibility back in this public venue. This was psychologist B. She and I had extensive conversation about sensitive information, which I would never have discussed had we not formed a clinical relationship. I even filled out the intake form she sent me and mailed it back. She then canceled our following appointment for the testing a week before the initial review, and I didn't get the evaluation completed after all, though she had all of my sensitive information. At least at the initial review, Dr. Flowers got on record saying that there was no indication of the alleged clinical presentation in the file. I thought, oh, well, good enough. But then psychologist B came to psychologist A's informal interview as a supportive consultant to her about the exact same case she had heard all about from me. I was left too shocked and uncomfortable to best advocate for myself and answer questions. That same day, I wrote to Ms. Michelson copying psychologist B that night, not detailing the entire thing because I wanted to salvage the last shreds of my privacy, but enough that it should have been the end of it. I found out several months later that despite this, psychologist B didn't just not step aside, but she actually was appointed as psychologist A's practice monitor. I learned that she was given my, I'm going to use air quotes, clinical record, a clinical record written about me that this board established had contained notes for sessions I wasn't even at, was missing notes for times I was there, and multiple versions of the alleged goings on at various sessions that conflict with each other, none of which, at least for my copies, had a verified date stamp like we would get with an EHR. Perhaps because there were three cases that day that psychologist A's case was heard, which I'd imagine was a huge burden on staff, a lot was missing from the findings of fact, including these details of the records lacking credibility. Add to it that I was initially told that practice monitors only get the board order, not the complainant's clinical file, and that R-426-305 is in alignment with that, stating that aside from the board and were required by law, the respondent's lawyers are the only people who get access to that sensitive client information. So last month, you made the choice about whether you have jurisdiction to hear the concerns about psychologist B's choice to get involved first with me, the complainant, and then with psychologist A, the respondent, on the exact same case, and then to take on a practice monitoring position in that capacity. My complaint detailed a long span of time, with 5 months of the details occurring before she was even in her role as a practice monitor. You heard the summary and then went into executive session for like 20 minutes for legal advice, came back out, and your two non-clinical members made these comments. One, a public administrator declared that I was never actually a client and that I had not filled out paperwork, and she read inaccurate information into the public record that psychologist B and I had only discussed insurance and scheduling. No, that was just the text messages, because after what I had learned in the other matter, I would never put clinical content in a text ever again. It was in the phone calls that I detailed in the complaint. The second, an attorney with what had historically been a civil libertarian bent, declared that the entire thing was outside of your jurisdiction due to the statute giving practice monitors qualified immunity for their work in that role. But the bulk of my complaint was about my own interactions with psychologist B and her choice to become practice monitor in that context. The board member stated that the statute's interpretation should be a liberal one, in which psychologist B's qualified immunity should be retroactive for the half of a year prior to her appointment as practice monitor. And then that was it. No clinical member of the board commented. The whole situation outside of these proclamations was behind closed doors. And as I've observed Ms. Galvin to be clear and concise, I cannot imagine that she took 20 minutes to explain the jurisprudence to you all. The open meeting policies the open meeting policies mean that we're supposed to have access to these discussions. Now I'm left wondering where my rights are as my clinical record, as far as my clinical record with psychologist B, whether my privacy is safe, et cetera. I get that you might not want to deal with something that may have felt complicated or labor intensive, but what precedent did your decision set? Why did you say the things into the record that weren't accurate? And where does it leave me as far as my right to healthcare privacy, knowing that someone with qualified immunity has access to inaccurate documents about me that based on the practice rules I read shouldn't even be the case? Thank you. And also as an aside, I heard the entire meeting last month, and I just wanted to comment on both how a behavior analyst respondent in one case and a complainant in another were treated. Putting the former in a hot seat over what appears to be a eventual report by her employer and drilling her about phone records, and then referring to a complainant as a buzzsaw and seeming to blame her for what happened in therapy, that was really unsettling. As someone wearing both the hats of a clinician and a sister profession, and as a complainant before you, it was really distressing to watch. It's uncomfortable enough to have to show up here, whether as a complainant or a respondent, and I would imagine those things could make distress worse for folks before you. Thank you for hearing my concerns.
Thank you, HB. We appreciate you addressing the board. Do we have any additional public comment or any additional requests to speak? Hearing none, we will move to agenda item number 6, consent agenda, discussion, consideration, and possible action. Agenda item number 6 is the consent agenda. For the record, are there any recusals from items on the consent agenda? I have two. I am recused from applicants Melissa Harrison and Carissa Glenn. Any additional recusals? Hearing none, a board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I move to approve the consent agenda.
I'll second.
Dino seconds.
We have a motion and a second. Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. We will now move to agenda. Oh, we have 2 minutes before agenda item 7.
Yes, Dr. Davis-Wilson, maybe we can do number 9. We do have the parties to that matter present.
Perfect. All right. Agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to renewal application submitted by Jill Hayes. Ms. Poe, would you please provide us a summary of this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. On May 6th, the board office received Dr. Hayes' psychologist's application for license renewal. Board staff noted that Dr. Hayes answered yes to question number 10 of the renewal application, which pertains to investigations. Dr. Hayes provided an explanation and documentation, which board members have a copy of, regarding a complaint that was lodged with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights. And so board members have all of that material. On June 2nd, board staff was notified that Dr. Hayes' attorney, Marky Stewart, would be representing her in this matter at today's board meeting. So both Dr. Hayes and Ms. Stewart are present for the meeting. On June 3rd, which was yesterday, the attorney, Ms. Stewart, provided board staff a copy of the dismissal letter from the Office of Civil Rights stating that no HIPAA violations were found and that they had closed the case. And Ms. Pacman did send board members those materials last night. And as I said, Dr. Hayes and her attorney, Ms. Stewart, are both present in the meeting. I believe Ms. Stewart would like to make a brief statement, and Dr. Hayes is available if board members do have questions. Board staff is just basically asking direction from the board on whether or not Dr. Hayes' renewal application can be processed. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Ms. Stewart and Dr. Hayes, if you would please introduce yourselves just for the record, and then Ms. Stewart, you may make a statement.
Thank you, and good morning, members of the board. My name is Marquise Stewart, and I represent Dr. Jill Hayes, who is present today and happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jill Hayes.
Thank you. You may proceed, Ms. Stewart.
Good morning, members of the board. So as I mentioned, Dr. Hayes is present today and happy to answer any questions regarding this matter. However, before you begin your discussion or ask any questions of Dr. Hayes, I had planned to provide the board with an oral summary of the OCR matter. Now, I will be happy to provide that summary as originally planned if the board would like. However, I understand you have a busy agenda today. So if the board believes that yesterday's dismissal by the OCR is dispositive of this matter and that the board does not need to ask any questions of Dr. Hayes or substantively discuss this matter before renewing her license, simply out of respect for your time, I don't believe that oral summary of the facts is necessary. So I'd therefore just like to ask the board if they would still like to delve into the facts surrounding this OCR matter before I go ahead and provide that summary.
Thank you. Board members, do you have a preference with the information provided to us? Ms. Shreve.
Just want to confirm, the only concern that the office had regards to her application was this issue with this HIPAA violation, which has now been resolved. Is that correct? Resolved in the sense that they found no findings.
That is correct.
Right. Is that, Heidi, is that correct? I just want to confirm from our office. So that's the only reason this has been, then I don't see a need for a oral summary. I think that takes care of the issue.
Thank you, Ms. Shreve. Do we need a motion on this application?
Yes, you do. You need to direct staff, if there are no other issues, that you would approve the renewal of the license.
I'll make a motion that we approve the renewal of the license for Dr. Jill Hayes.
Diana, seconds.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed?
I do believe Dr. Malott is still absent.
Okay. The motion does carry. Thank you, Ms. Stewart and Dr. Hayes, for your time and for getting that additional information over to us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. The time is now 8:48. So we will move to item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed consent agreement and order pertaining to complaint number 2112. For Von Saltzoris and possibly motion to vacate the informal interview. The board may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A2 to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confident by state or federal law, and or ARS 38-431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. Agenda item number 7, Ms. Michelson, would you please provide us a summary of this matter?
Excuse me, this is Melanie LaBoy. I need to recuse myself from this matter.
Thank you, Ms. LaBoy.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will provide a quick overview. At the board's last meeting on May 7th, an initial case review was conducted for the pending complaint against Dr. Tesoris, which was filed by client RB, who had alleged multiple ethical issues that occurred during the course of treatment. The board voted to move the case to an informal interview to be held at a future date, and alternatively directed Ms. Galvin and Dr. Tesoris through his attorney to enter into settlement negotiations. At this meeting, the board outlined the terms of a consent agreement that it would be willing to consider. Subsequent to this, a proposed consent agreement and order for probation, supervision, and continuing education was subsequently sent to Dr. Tesoris for his review and consideration, which he accepted as drafted and signed on May 26. The agreement specifies the following terms. His license will be placed on probation for 12 months. After 6 months, he can petition the board in writing to be released with the practice monitor's recommendation. He will meet with a pre-approved practice monitor for a minimum of 2 hours twice monthly. The practice monitor shall review a minimum of 5 patient files each quarter. Professional guidance will be provided in the areas of ethics, clinical documentation, record keeping, transference, use of personal disclosures in therapy, electronic communication with clients outside of treatment, importance of professional consultation, treating personality and substance use disorders, termination of services, and any other topic deemed pertinent by the practice monitor. And additionally, he would be required to complete 10 hours in CE in the areas of personality disorders and substance use disorders, and that would need to be completed within 6 months of the effective date. The proposed consent agreement that is before you today is a disciplinary action that would be reported to the data bank and would serve as a final disposition in this matter. If it was accepted by the board, there would also need to be a motion to vacate the informal interview. I do see that Dr. Tissot-Soris and his attorney, Dr. Akins, are present today, as well as the complainant, RB. I do believe that both parties did want to address the board and make a statement. So this concludes my summary, but please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. RB, I see that you are joining us today. If you would please unmute yourself, introduce yourself using only your initials, and make a brief statement.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I have written a statement, and it is within the 5-minute time limit. Okay, so Vaughn telling me he sexualizes his patients and gets therapy for it caused me anxiety throughout our treatment. He flirted with me, asked me if I would let him make a pass at me, made sexual puns. He called me when he knew I was in the bathtub, and I provided evidence of that. He asked me to repeat my sexual encounters and constantly bit his lower lip as he listened. He has been dishonest to the board about several things. I have submitted further evidence to the board, including my phone records with his calls highlighted and a transcript of our session on December 21st. In that transcript, I'm asking him to clarify what he meant by us needing to be close, expressing that I felt uncomfortable with his request and that I did not like feeling attached to him or dependent. And I asserted that I needed him to know that I was not in therapy with him due to romantic interest in him. He explained that my, quote, real feelings of attachment, dependence, and my texting him were encouraging signs that therapy was working, and that we were now, I quote, cooking with butter, and that my feelings of struggle were signs of progress. He went on to say that as our work became more meaningful to me, the more devastating it would be if it ends, and then stated he would never turn on me. He also asserted I was frustrated we couldn't be romantic outside of therapy. He said this many times throughout the therapy, and it was irritating that he could not stop insinuating I wanted him sexually. Vaughn was having a personal relationship with me, as he has told the board he was talking about me extensively in his personal therapy. I find it creepy that his therapist was his consultant in my case, and Vaughn stated he didn't document it because it was his personal therapy. I gave Vaughn many opportunities to end our therapy easily, but he insisted I stay. It seemed that the only therapeutic goal was to become close with each other, and I did my best to follow his lead, but I was uncomfortable with it, and I told him this many times. I would have gladly accepted a referral, as I expressed infinitely that I felt anxious about him and that it was not a good fit. I felt that Vaughn wouldn't let me go because of feelings he had toward me and that he enjoyed my attention. As my doctor, he had power over me, and when he told me, and you can read this in the transcript, that he enjoys working with me, feels good about our work together, telling me he hopes that I do not end it, I stayed. However, I needed to be sure he wanted me to stay as my doctor and not due to his sexualizing me. So in our last session, I confronted him about his telling me he sexualizes his patients for the first time and asked him to afterward tell me a non-sexual reason why he wanted me to stay. He chose instead to immediately end therapy. I was shocked and in disbelief that he could be so cold and asked him to not end in this way. This reality was too harsh to ingest without counsel. He had built an attachment and a dependence in me. Once we spoke on the phone the next evening, he simply said he had moved on to other patients and my spots were gone. I asked him for a referral or a last session, and he only offered me a spot on his wait list. I then cried as he listened, and he hung up on me. This therapist harmed me on purpose. I told him later that night I was going to file a complaint against him. The next morning I called for my notes, and he said we can get past this, and he wanted me to come back to therapy. But once we met, I quickly realized he was only there to pull me through a fake termination session to cover up his abandonment. He did not attempt to help me in any way. He interrogated me and refused to apologize. He blamed me that I broke his trust and that my upset feelings were derived from him not being available to me as a sexual partner. He offered me termination sessions only if I agreed to not file a complaint. A couple days later, I told him that I would be filing a complaint and that I had a new therapist. Yet Vaughn hounded me, calling me many times, telling me he wanted another session with me, until I finally told him to not contact me again. It is disgusting that this man relentlessly asserts that he is wanted sexually from his patient. It is crude that in his complaint response, he stated, "I wanted to engage him in a sexual act." It only proves that Vaughn is a manipulator that thrives off the power differential to gratify himself sexually. At the last board meeting, I heard Dr. Gill say that he knows he isn't supposed to diagnose complainants, but did in fact announce a secondary diagnosis of me in open session, which has since been retracted from the recording. He also said I trapped therapists and said I'm a buzzsaw that Vaughn walked into. I've never had any intention of causing injury to this therapist. Instead, I protected him at the detriment of myself. I offered to settle this with mediation that he refused. Dr. Gill also spoke in code saying cases like this without defining that to the public. I wonder what he means when the fact is that this therapist told me he sexualizes his patients and that permeated the treatment and has resulted in the situation. I hope that other women who listen to this are not put off from filing a complaint out of fear board members will armchair diagnose them in open session and do not respect them when they are bravely telling the truth out of self-protection and protection to the public. Vaughn needs education and guidance in tailing his inappropriate sexualizing his patients, as he has expressed this is common for him to feel, and he has many other female patients. Thank you.
Thank you, RB. I believe that Dr. Saltsoros and his legal representation are both present. If you guys could introduce yourself for the record, and you may make a statement.
Yes, good morning, board members. I'm Dr. Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. I know that Dr. Tsasaris is here with us, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Yes, hello, I'm Dr. Vaughn Tsasaris.
Board Chair, actually, in light of the comments that we've already been through and the extensive review of the matter from the prior meeting with the board, neither myself nor Dr. Tsasaris has anything further to add, and we're satisfied to accept the consent agreement as written and drafted by board staff and your board counsel.
Thank you. Board members, do you have any questions for the doctor or his attorney? Ms. Shreve?
Oh, I'm sorry, no questions for them. I just had a comment on the overall thing.
Any questions? All right, we will move into deliberation. Ms. Shreve?
I just wanted to say I appreciate the comments that were made by the complainant. I think that, you know, her last comment that the doctor needs education and guidance is something I think that the board agreed with, and that's why we have the consent decree. It does have a practice monitor that he will have to be working with within the next year, and also requires education credit. So, I'm hoping that with our consent decree and the parameters in that decree that it is helps educate and, you know, the doctor going forward.
Thank you. Additional comments?
I'll make a motion.
Go ahead.
I'll motion that we vacate the informal interview with the knowing that I'm going to make a motion to approve the consent agreement. Do we do the vacate first, Ms. Galvin?
No, you can do them together in one motion.
Okay, thank you. Then I make a motion that we vacate the informal interview and that we approve the consent agreement.
Dino seconds.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, do we need a roll call? Thank you. Ms. Poe, will you please do a roll call?
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Dr. Malott? Oh, that's right. Dr. Malott left the meeting. Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Motion is unanimous with one recusal. Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, RB, Dr. Akins, Dr. Sosoris, for joining us today. We appreciate your time. We will now move to agenda item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to Committee on Behavior Analyst recommendation regarding the following complaint and or initial case review of the following complaints. Complaint number 2117, Jeffrey Siegel. It is now 9:01. We will be reviewing licensed behavior analyst Jeffrey Siegel. Dr. Davey, would you please provide a brief summary of this case to the board?
Yes, my puppy has decided to start barking at this very particular instance, so I apologize for that for those on the phone. So give me 1 second, I'll close the door.
While he's doing that, I will clarify that this complaint was opened by the board and therefore there is no complainant. All right. Perhaps we could move to, if we'd like to hold this item for just a moment. Do we have a quorum to move on? I believe so. We're just missing Dr. Malott. We could, while we're waiting, I would be happy to review complaint B for Ms. Brandy Collins. The time is 9:03, and we'll move to agenda item 8B, complaint T2102 concerning Brandy Collins. I am the lead on this complaint, so I will provide a brief summary of this case to the board. The board opened the complaint against Ms. Collins after reviewing a application and complaint regarding a applicant, behavior analyst applicant who received supervision from Ms. Collins. Ms. Collins is a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Texas and was not licensed in Arizona. However, the supervisee was in Arizona. It was unclear as to where the practice hours of the supervision occurred, and Ms. Collins had not attended any of the other proceedings, and so we weren't quite clear as to what her role was in providing services in the state of Arizona. We did request that a complaint be opened. Ms. Collins did come before the CBA. I do not believe she's here today. However, she did provide us information regarding the nature of the supervision she provided. Because the applicant that she was supervising was a BCABA, she only had a portion of what we call unrestricted hours that needed to be completed. Those unrestricted hours do not necessarily involve a direct patient. And so the assignments that she was providing her were not specific to anybody in Arizona receiving services. And so the Committee on Behavior Analysts were comfortable with the information provided by Ms. Collins and recommended that the board dismiss this complaint. Board staff, I know that we had noticed Ms. Collins of this meeting. We also informed her in the CBA that we would be discussing this today. I do not see her on the phone, but did you guys hear anything from her?
Madam Chair, I did not. You are correct that we did discuss at last week's meeting that this would be placed on today's agenda. I also emailed her the notice, but I have not heard back in any capacity.
Thank you. All right. Without her present, then do we have any discussions related to this matter? Dr. Caterino?
I don't know if this is appropriate, but has this practice where she provides supervision to other Arizona trainees? Does that matter?
Dr. Caterino did express to us that she does not generally provide supervision in that capacity, but that she was on an alumni list with her university, and the unit and the applicant had reached out to her separate, and she went ahead and gave it a chance. She also provided information pertaining to the agreement that the applicant would still be under the supervision of a licensed behavior analyst, which for her BCABA hours, she was under the supervision. So she was receiving supplemental support from this Texas supervisor, but still supervised by another licensed behavior analyst here in Arizona. She understood that to be sufficient in meeting the statutory requirements. And then when this complaint came about she was notified that the hours couldn't count toward licensure, she did go ahead and terminate that contract, and she has stated that she does not have any interest in remote supervision moving forward.
No, yeah, I remember some of that. I just wondered if there had been any record of anyone else that we know of.
Okay. Yeah, she says that this was the only one.
Thank you.
Additional comments? Do we have a motion?
I'll move for the dismissal.
And I'll second that. All in favor, please indicate so by saying, any further discussion? Sorry. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. And we will go back to complaint number A. And that's going to be with Jeffrey Siegel. The time is now 9:08. Dr. Davey, would you please provide us an overview of this complaint?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, board staff, for being patient with me on the puppy. Mr. Siegel was issued his behavior analyst license by the board back in 2014. He's also been certified with the Behavior Analyst Certification Board since 2012. Back in March of 2021, a complaint was opened up against Mr. Siegel for his unresponsiveness with regards to signing off on a former supervisee's supervision documentation. That began a kind of a process of board staff trying to track down Mr. Siegel, and in the notes or in the files, you will see that staff has made efforts since February 22nd to get information from this individual. Multiple follow-up emails in March, the committee has heard, committee behavior analysts has heard more discussion about this individual. On responsiveness to our questions. We've had a complaint notification sent to his home. We have emailed with regard to the status of hearing about this. We have mailed a subpoena. We have done that via certified mail. It was signed for, still no response. We emailed again on May 28th, noticing the individual of this particular board notice. And board staff, correct me if I'm wrong, but as of today, June 4th, 9:09 a.m., we have not heard from this individual, correct? Thank you.
That is correct, Dr. Davey. He was mailed and emailed today's notice. And as you mentioned earlier, with regard to last week's CBA meeting, he was actually issued a subpoena for his appearance and did not comply with that.
Yep. And I think, most concerning is that Mr. Siegel is currently living and practicing in California. California does not require licensure, so his BA, his certification from the Board of Behavior Analysts is sufficient to practice there. Is also based on an email that I'd sent back to board staff. I was interested to know if he was supervising others because he's obviously struggling at his completing his commitments to his supervisees. The BACB responded back to board staff in the affirmative that he currently has two registered behavior techs underneath him. After discussion, the Committee on Behavior Analysts unanimously recommended that we forward this board for further review based on the following violations. The first violation being 32-2091-12BB, failing to furnish information in a timely manner to the board or its investigators or representatives if requested or subpoenaed by the board as prescribed in that article. ARS 32-2091-12DD, violating an ethical standard adopted by the board and its as it relates to section 2.0 and 9.01 of the BACB's ethical code for behavior analysts. And then ARS 32-2091-12K, violating any federal or state law that relates to the practice of behavior analysis or to obtain a license to practice behavior analysis as it relates to our ARS 32-2066-BB or B. The reality is that the Committee of Behavior Analysts is frustrated, as is staff, that this individual is not responding to us. We are concerned that he is engaged in the practice of supervision elsewhere in the country. And, you know, I think as part of the summary of my report, before we kind of move past that, the Committee of Behavior Analysts is also interested in how it could possibly notify the BACB of this complaint. And so I move that as kind of the summary forward. I think there was also some discussion that we may need some legal advice from Ms. Galvin with regarding to our jurisdiction, or not maybe our jurisdiction, but how to adjudicate this matter due to the lack of participation at this particular point. And I'll pause there, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Mr. Siegel, just last, I just want to check one more time. If you are on the phone, please unmute yourself. Hearing nothing, we can move straight into deliberations. If there is a recommendation for action, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we go into executive session to discuss legal advice from our attorney.
I will second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Ms. Poe, please time warp us into the next location. I wanted to take a moment to address a question for you, Dr. Gill. So with behavior analysts, we have two types of supervision. We have supervision toward certification, and oftentimes you'll hear those individuals called mentees, supervisees, students, or trainees. But then we have, because we're a tiered service provider, similar to like in Arizona where we have the BHP and the BHT, and kind of the BHP is still clinically responsible for all of the work of the BHT, the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, so our national certification board, has the BCBA, a BCABA, and then the RBTs. And that BCBA is responsible for supervision and the competencies, essentially. So they have to ensure that direct line technician is able to implement the programs as prescribed, that they are being supervised a minimum of 5% of any of that implementation, that supervision's documented, that they the RBTs actually have their own, the technicians themselves have their own ethics codes that they too have to follow. And so there is, by the National Certification Board, there is a kind of an abundance of standards that are set forth for that type of supervision. And there's the same for the supervision towards certification as well. In Arizona, the behavior analysts are BHPs, like we are written in the statute as BHPs. And so we have some of that supervisory delegatory ability to behavior technicians. But again, that clinical responsibility still falls under the behavior analyst. And so I think that that's for me and Dr. Davey, likely that's one of the concerns of having supervisees in it, for having an applicant who is supervising others when they're not responsive to our requests and the complaint was brought forth over a supervision concern, right? And so when they're supervising others, even technicians in that capacity, they're still, again, clinically responsible for what those technicians are doing. And I think that's where the committee's concerns are, is that in him being non-responsive, we are sitting forth with potential technicians that are out practicing and may or may not be getting adequate supervision. And I'll tell you that the BACB only does a registry for their technicians. They don't for their applicants working toward certification. So while we know he's supervising two technicians, we don't know whether or not he's supervising others towards licensure or certification, because they don't keep a record of that. And so he may have additional people who intend to get licensed certified and or licensed. And we wouldn't know that unless those people came forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Absolutely. Do we have any further discussion? Dr. Davey, would you like to lead the deliberations?
Sorry, space bar is not working. I don't know that there's much to deliberate here. I think it's a pretty clear cut case of just non-responsiveness. It's concerning because the individual is continuing to supervise young professionals in our field to become licensed behavior analysts. We've already had one individual that reached out to us expressing concerns that they could not get their documentation signed off on in a timely fashion. And we have an individual that is really just thumbing his nose at the process here in Arizona, even though we have the right to work with him per his license. There's also the concern of, you know, on a go forward basis, once we get to what will be my recommendation to move this to a formal hearing, is reaching out to the BACB so that they can also begin engagement with this individual, given that he's now practicing according to our information in the state of California, but still lists on the BACB's website an Arizona address. And so that is really, you know, all I have to say about it. And I am more than happy to make the motion to move this to a formal hearing, and hopefully we can get this on the next meeting so that we can kind of pick up the pace to protect those that might be possibly impacted by this individual's lack of professionalism. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Dr. Gill?
Dr. Davey, is there anything that we can do or are there anything that can be done to support this claimant so that she can received her license hours and qualified to be certified?
Yes, we did get through that process. The correct. We've got the signature. That was the only response we received from the individual, was that, you know, that had been signed off on, and then we've not heard since that. And those were extraordinary efforts to get him to sign off on that by both the supervisee and board staff.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate the question.
And I'll add to that, with behavior in the rules for behavior analysts, after multiple attempts to reach the supervisor, there are other avenues that a licensee or an applicant may go to submit documentation in lieu of the documentation the supervisor is providing. So we do have kind of a workaround should this become an issue in the future. Dr. Davey, I wanted to clarify on your motion. So we want to do a formal hearing. Could we direct in that motion to include, or direct in that notice of the formal hearing, the inclusion of the option to complete a consent agreement for surrender of license should the individual choose not to come to formal hearing? And also with that, a recommendation or direct board staff to just make the board of behavior, the certifying board, aware of the location change, and that it is our understanding that he is not in Arizona and is actually practicing in California.
I'd be open to those amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Then I will second that motion. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Oh, yep, Ms. Greiner.
Thank you. So I think I'm of the view that with non-compliance of subpoena matters, because the board has already, you know, taken multiple, has tried to contact the licensee multiple times and the licensee is not responsive, that what that tells me is any further action at the administrative level is probably not going to get us the results. Ultimately, the interest of the board is to get the records in order to evaluate the underlying complaint. We have nothing against the licensee. We don't want to revoke the licensee's license to practice. We just want the records to evaluate what's going on. So with that in mind, in terms of the menu of options that the board has, the option that I would prefer is to go to the Superior Court for enforcement of the subpoena instead of trying to get an additional administrative hearing, a formal interview in front of the psychologist board. Because at that point, that indicates to the licensee that this is a serious matter. They should be responding to calls for information. They should be responding to subpoenas. They should be contacting the board if the board contacts them. Those are sort of elementary matters that all licensees have a duty to comply with. So given the options that we have, my preference would be to direct staff to seek an enforcement of the subpoena in the state superior court.
Mr. Dunner, can I ask a question? With the individual residing in the state of California, how does something like that work in terms of forcing kind of compliance, if you will?
Well, they are a licensee. We already have jurisdiction over them.
No, but I'm saying, like, if you're saying the Superior Court's going to compel them differently than our subpoena, you know, does a marshal show up at his door? Like, I'm asking, like, what is this? What makes this different than what we've already done in terms of sending a subpoena?
Well, so in my view, at that point, because it's a court matter, you know, there are already procedures in place to get those documents served. There are procedures in place to get contempt of court orders. There are procedures in place in Superior Court to do many more things than what we can accomplish at the board level. And the other reason that that option is preferable is ultimately we want a speedy resolution of the documents that we are seeking. It seems to me that we are jumping to revocation or suspension before taking a lesser step of just obtaining the documents. And that's why this whole thing started.
Dr. Meyer.
Mr. Dinar, what would be the additional time frame to go through Superior Court? Just a rough estimate.
I mean, my guess is going to be as good as yours, you know, few weeks to a few months. The alternative is we institute a formal hearing and the licensee doesn't show up. We then send it to the OAH. The OAH tries to get the licensee to show up. The licensee doesn't show up, comes back to the board. We try to get the license in front of us. The licensee doesn't show up. And then we end up in the Superior Court. And that process is months longer than going to Superior Court, in my mind.
Ms. Galvin, can't we revoke after the formal hearing?
Yes, that's true. You could hold the formal hearing before this board or go to a formal hearing before OWA. And the end of that decision would be, or the end of that proceeding would be either a recommendation from OWA to revoke, or the board could make a decision to revoke at that time. I think that this hearing would be pretty expedient, pretty cut and dry, could probably be held in front of the board. He has to have 30 days notice. So in your meeting in about 60 days, and then we could render a decision immediately after that hearing. I wouldn't expect the hearing to take more than probably 30 or 40 minutes.
Okay. So he's been given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to respond. This is a requirement of licensure to respond to the board. So I see no reason to go after yet another subpoena, but to move this forward as quickly as possible to potential revocation, unless he chooses to respond. So I'm more along the line of Dr. Davies' motion.
Ms. Shreve, did you have a comment? Okay. Thank you for that discussion. We do have a motion and a second. Do you need a roll call vote?
I would prefer one, yes.
Okay. Ms. Poe, if you could please do a roll call.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes. And I want to thank Mr. Dinar for giving us some other options that we were not aware of. And so I do appreciate him sharing those options. So thank you.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
I'm going to vote no, but, only because I think the preferable option is to go to Superior Court. That's not to say that the formal interview option is bad in any way. It's just a less preferable option in my head.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Ms. LaBoy?
Yes.
Dr. Malott? I believe Dr. Malott must still be absent. Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
This is Dr. Malott. I'm here. Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, I vote yes.
Eight yeses, one no, motion carries.
Thank you. And I do also want to echo what Dr. Davey said. Mr. Dinar, your input and the options that you've presented to us are very helpful. It's nice to hear your perspective on some of those things. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. All right, we will now move to agenda item number 10. Yes.
This is Ms. Poe. I would like to go ahead and give out the first CE code word. For anybody that is attending for CE, the first code word is father.
Father.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will move to agenda item number 10. This is request for clarification filed by Lauren Blake, pursuant to 41.1001.02 relating to the board's interpretation of ARS 32.2071, 32.2072, and 32.2071, 32.2071, 32.2073. Ms. Pacman, will you please provide the board a summary of this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. Before you is a petition pursuant to ARS 41-1001.02, which is a clarification or interpretation, clarification of interpretation or application exemption. Subsection A provides that before submitting an application, a petitioner may request from the agency clarification of a statute or rule. And I provide the language from that statute. It is, this petition is submitted by Dr. Lauren Blake. Dr. Blake holds a temporary license with this board, and I provided you with the timeline of that matter. She applied on September 7th, 2020, which was prior to the effective date of the ERPP Part 2. She was granted that license on December 14th, and she intends to apply for an unrestricted license once her postdoctoral training program is complete in August of 2022. And the basis of this is whether a temporary license
prior to the ACCP Part 2 effective date, whether that person is exempt from the ACCP Part 2 by virtue of the fact the temporary license was granted prior to that date, or whether as a new applicant under a new application for an unrestricted license, which would be issued after November 1st of 2020, is that applicant subject to the ACCP Part 2? And I believe, yes, she is. Dr. Blake is here, and I think she is prepared to summarize her petition request for you.
Thank you. Dr. Blake, if you could please introduce yourself, and then you may proceed with your summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. Thank you for the summary, Ms. Pekonen. I do have a couple of talking points. As Ms. Pekonen mentioned, I submitted a petition, and I'm not sure if everyone has access to what is written in that petition, but my biggest goal with submitting this petition was to just get some clarity about the confusion I had regarding whether or not I needed to take the enhanced ACCP. As Ms. Pekonen mentioned, I did submit my license application prior to the November 1st rollout, at which point folks would be subject to having to take the enhanced ACCP after that timeline. The reason that I applied for supervised temporary licensure is because I wanted to count my postdoctoral hours towards my specialization in neuropsychology. And as Ms. Pekonen mentioned, my goal after completing my postdoc in August 2022 is to become independently licensed. I wanted to get the ACCP Part 1 out of the way early on in my postdoc so that I could focus on my training. My understanding of the statute 32-2073 was that individuals would be required to take an additional examination, such as the enhanced ACCP, if they were licensed in another jurisdiction or if they had applied after that November 1st deadline. And I do not believe that I meet either of those criteria, as I completed my application prior to November 1, and I currently have a supervised license in this jurisdiction of Arizona. So for those reasons, I don't believe that I need to take the enhanced ACCP, but again, I just have some confusion and was hoping for clarification. I'm happy to answer additional questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Board members, do we have any questions or discussion related to this matter? And we do also have the option of going into executive session if we need any legal advice from the attorney.
This is Dr. Malott.
Yes.
And I think I can ask this question in open session. Since she did apply, and I think our deadline was as long as they applied by November 1, they would just need to take ECCP 1. Maybe Ms. Folks can advise us as to the date and timeline.
Dr. Malott, she did apply for the temporary license prior to the November 2020 deadline for the ECCP Part 2. Yeah. And she was granted that temporary license. She has not yet applied for the independent license, and that would then trigger her requirement to take the ECCP enhanced, the Part 2.
So the temporary license is not part of the exemption? I mean, the cutoff?
No, because her application, she still has to file an application for the full unrestricted license, which requires the ECCP Part 2, if that application is filed after the November deadline. There's also case law that provides that if your application is pending and the licensure requirements change during that process, you are still required to meet the new licensure requirements. So if she applied for the temporary license, was granted that license, but is still waiting to be awarded her independent full licensure, and the application requirements change, the licensure requirements change, which they did, that now that the ACCP Part 2 is required, she would be required to meet those new standards.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is Kathy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ms. Folks, and then we'll go to Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Malott, board members, the confusion, staff was somewhat confused with this particular situation at first and became aware of a conflict that initially didn't present itself to us. And the temporary license is issued under 32-2073. And the independent license is issued under 32-2071. And so the initial application for the temporary license, even though we use the same application, the license applied for is completely separate. And so what we're trying to find out, it appears, the question is the initial license application for the temporary license under 32-2073, can it be considered an initial application for the independent license under 32-2071? I believe that may be the question before the board.
And the answer would be no, they're two very different distinct licenses.
Madam Chair?
Let me get to Dr. Meyer real quick, and then I will call on you, Mr. Diner. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when you get a temporary license, can you take the EPPP during that period of time that would then roll into your application for mm-hmm. permanent licensure?
Yes.
Is that... Mm-hmm. So...
If I may... Answer, Dr. Meyer?
Please. Yes, Ms. Folks.
The EPPP score and other verifications that were provided to the board for the temporary license application can and do transfer to an independent license, but the temporary license itself does not transfer to an independent application, independent license application.
So when Dr. Blake received the letter stating that she had a temporary license, did it say she needed to take the EPPP only and not the enhanced?
Yes, sir. That is exactly it. The approval for the temporary license and the issuance letter indicated she was approved by the board for EPPP Part 1 only. And under the temporary license at that time was not subject to Part 2.
So to me, it makes sense that she would not need to take the Part 2, because first of all, she started the process of licensure prior to the date that we added the Part 2. She was also directed by us to take Part 1 only, and I recognize Ms. Galvin's point that if the law changes, then they're responsible for that. But the rule we set was that if your application is before, what, November 1st, then we go with the Part 1 only. So, and I helped look over the spreadsheet of all the different permutations on who would take what, and I missed this one, but I don't feel like Dr. Blake should have to be the rules shouldn't have to be changed on her. To me, it makes sense that she takes the EPPP Part 1 only, and then that fulfills her requirements for her application for full licensure.
Would the board care to receive legal advice?
So moved.
I would move to get legal advice.
I'll second.
Motion and a second. We'll go ahead and go into executive session for legal advice. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. everybody back. Everybody has returned. So we will continue discussion. Any board members with additional comments? Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling here. Very appreciative of Ms. Galvin's recommendation, but I have this desire to go against legal advice. Or pursue a statutory option, similar to what we did with Argosy students, to somehow address the limited number of people that have had an active temporary license prior to November 1st, 2020, to set the deadline later for just that subset of when the ECCC Part 2 goes into effect. It's, we chose to set November 1st across the board, but we've now identified a potential issue for a group of people. This problem's not going to continue forward for longer than 2 years and 2.5 years. It's addressed now, and it's just this group of people in limbo. And so if legally we need to say separate licenses, when you submit your full application, you have to take Part 1 and Part 2. Is there a legal way through statute change to make an exclusion for that group of people? Because I just don't think it's... I think we would have tried to come up with a better way when we implemented Part 2 if we had identified this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Gill.
Madam Chair, do we know how many people are in this subset that Dr. Meyer refers to?
That was going to be one of my questions as well. Ms. Folks, do you have that information, or is that information that we could easily gather?
I can get it in a moment or two. I just need to pull up the spreadsheet.
That would be, I think that would be helpful. And I know that, you know, one of the difficulties with seeking legislative changes, because I know that this happens, and I know that the solution would be some sort of legislation to fix it to where that wouldn't be required. Now, we can obviously educate and notify people ahead of time of, hey, just FYI, you do apply under these standards now. These standards apply. Therefore, you may want to start getting that work done or preparing for that work prior to your application. We could change this from a legislative purpose, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we would be looking at the earliest changes in summer of 2022, possibly even, you know, late fall of 2022, depending on how it goes. And I don't know how many people would then be affected by then, because of all the other changes. So I think knowing, one, how many people are affected now, and then, while I agree that seeking legislation is a solution, I'm not sure that it would apply to those people by the time it actually was sought and done. I definitely think we could direct board staff to add that to our list of things that to our list of statute changes. That way we can revisit it when it's time to have that conversation this fall, because again, we've got to wait until sessions are opening to be able to draft all of that. So I think we could add it to our running list of potential statutory changes, and evaluate it then and see, would this still be beneficial to people? But I also like the suggestion of notifying folks now of, hey, just so that we're clear, the temporary licensure and the independent licensure are two different applications, and your application date for independent licensure is going to be the day that you apply for it, and therefore the standards set forth now will apply to that, or this, I should say, the standards set forth on the day you apply, because if it changes again, it's whatever is there the day they apply. So I think that getting board staff to notify those individuals would be helpful. And then knowing how many individuals are impacted would be helpful. Other comments, Dr. Catarino.
Well, this is exactly what I was thinking. The to go to a statutory change would delay the matter even further, when one of the concerns is that it would delay licensure for a group of individuals. I don't think it could be done within one or maybe 1 year or two. So I don't know if that's the solution.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Diner.
Thank you. I agree with your comment regarding, you know, trying to find some statutory solution to this conundrum. But in my mind, the problem is in 2073, it says that temporary licenses are not subject to renewal. So a person couldn't indefinitely be on a temporary license and practice in Arizona. And given... And correct me if I'm wrong, please. So any statutory solution we might be able to obtain is not going to address the question that is in front of us right now, is what to do with the applicants before November 1, 2020, right now. So that's my concern, because the temporary licenses are not subject to renewal. Any statutory fix might be too little, too late.
Madam Chair, this is Kathy, may I?
Yes, Ms. Phelps.
Currently, we have 25 active temporary licenses. Expiration dates range from August 7th, 2021 through April 13th, 2024. I do not know at this time if any of the recent issuances are people subject to part two. I'd have to do a little more research for that.
Dr. Meyer?
So you all make really good points. Statute route just doesn't make sense because of the time that it would take. So the only thing I see is that, I mean, we set the date for when this went into effect for the license, when ECPP part two started being required, to me, it seems pretty straightforward to say that for someone with a temporary license, there's a different date on when that goes into effect. And, because they're already under regulation with this board. Jane, I'm trying everything I can to come up with any kind of argument, but I mean, it just seems unfair. Mm-hmm. And I think we should have the ability to address that. It doesn't affect anybody applying for a new license. This is only 25 people that have a temporary, and we can set a different date for them because that's what makes sense and seems reasonable.
Thank you, Dr. Let me, Dr. Malott had raised her hand first. Let me get to Dr. Malott and then Dr. Gill and then Ms. Shreve.
My question is the date November 1 in statute? And I was going back trying to look for it.
It is not. It is a date that the board determined when the ECPP would, applicants would be required to take the ECPP.
So is there a possibility then, kind of going down Dr. Meyer's path on the board making a decision just on the date, because it's really the date that is maybe of question, and that is not in statute.
Madam Chair, may I try to address Dr. Malatz? I apologize for going out of turn.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I like the date option, meaning that if the board says, for example, that for applicants, for temporary license applicants who applied before November 1, 2020, the ECCC Part 2, they will have to take the ECCC Part 2 test if they do not apply for an independent license by November 1, 2022. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Yeah. Dr. Gill, did you want to
add? Just a quick comment. I just want to express similar sentiments. I think the board has some responsibility for not issuing, somebody else said this before, for not issuing clear guidelines at the time that we issued this date. So it looks like we might have an option here with Mr. Diner's proposal and Dr. Malat's remark about the date, and maybe there's a way out of this, because I think we're all uncomfortable with making a decision that seems on its face fundamentally unfair to the applicants, to these temporary licensed applicants.
So is it an option to take Mr. Dinar's suggestion and just put that in a substantial policy statement that we're clarifying that if you had applied for your temporary license by November 1st, whatever, then we go ahead to 2022. If you apply for your license by then, you don't have to take the ECCC Part 2. Ms. Galvin, is that, since that date was not arbitrary, but it was a decision, it's not in statute, is that something that we can just clarify that particular issue in maybe a policy statement?
You're asking whether that's an option?
Yes. That you feel we would be okay legally with?
Those are two different questions, Ms. Sharif.
Okay, so I know it's an option. It's licensed. So
and I won't answer the second question in open session.
All right. So given that, I'd like to go into executive session to see what Ms. Galvin thinks of that option legally.
All right, so that's a motion to go into executive session for legal advice. I will second that. Any further discussion?
I think she's already answered that.
Is it okay?
I mean, I.
But it's going to legal set. We've had
when she answered it before, we didn't talk about it wasn't in statute. We said it was it was a decision based on the date was a decision on by the board. It wasn't a statutory date.
A date like that does not need to be in statute. Your statute allows you to require an additional examination in addition to the ECCC. You, after months and months of consideration and discussion, decided that you would begin requiring that enhanced ECCC after November 1st of 2020.
We do have a motion in a second. Let's go ahead and take a vote on it. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
Nay.
The motion does carry. We will be going into executive session for legal advice.
Except Dr. Meyer.
Yeah, except Dr. Meyer. He's
out of here. Get him
out of here. Good try. Yeah, I'm
the nay was so depressing too.
All right, it looks like everybody is back. It does appear that letters were provided to all applicants, clearly outlining the expectations that at the time that the temporary and the independent license are two separate licenses, and that when one applies for the independent license, they will be required to meet the statutory requirements of that time, which as we have seen it, would require those applicants to complete part two of the ECPP. Do we have further discussion?
Do we have a motion on the table or not?
No.
Mr. Diners?
Is there a motion? Is there a request?
No, we haven't had a motion yet on the table.
Do we need a motion?
At this time, there's been no motion. The current ask of us is to provide a perspective of that statutory and its application, and to provide Dr. Blake with the information of whether or not, based on that interpretation, she should be planning to take the ECPP prior to eligibility under independent licensure. And at this time, the answer to that would be yes. You would need to, at the time that you apply for independent licensure, part one and part two are both required.
So technically, then we do not really have the option. I'm looking at the agenda item. What number is it?
Number 10.
So number 10, so we do not have an option. I think the suggestions that we've been discussing may need to be agendized for our next meeting. I'd like to see it on the agenda with the motion, you know, with the discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding a plan to address this particular situation. But as you said, Dr. Wilson, we would need to, you know, as you just stated to Dr. Hayes, the current stance as to how the statute reads.
Blake.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Shreve.
I don't think we need to put on the agenda that, I mean, I think a suggestion came up for the staff to send maybe reminder letters to the 25 people to, hey, just heads up, when you apply, you're going to need to go through the whole thing. As your letter stated, you know, you're just, if we are concerned they're going to be surprised, then I think it's nice to do a due diligence like that. But I don't know if there's any other discussion as far as what we can.
Well, I think I know at least Dr. Myers and myself, you know, I'd like to further consider Mr. Diner's suggestion, but we would need to agendize that.
Well, Dr. Mayer?
How is our response supposed to be conveyed for this agenda?
In the past, after the board discussion and if there's a consensus, staff, with my assistance, if they need it, would draft a letter to the petitioner explaining the board's position with respect to these statutes.
And can that explanation go out more broadly than to just Dr. Blake?
If that's what the board wants, Dr. Blake's letter would be a little bit more specific, right. And we could craft, based on the board's position, a general letter to the 25 current temporary license holders.
And can we resolve that now under this agenda item?
Yeah, I
have a question on that. Given, I know you wanted to keep it just to the Arizona, but there could be people from other states with a temporary license.
But
would we have to send anything to them also?
First, we need to know if we can talk about that right now under this agenda item.
I would be fine with a direction to staff pursuant to agenda item 10 and that discussion, that you would like a letter to go out to all 25 temporary license holders, clarifying the board's position that when they apply for independent licensure, part two will also be required.
Well said, thank you.
With statute.
And then could we add to the agenda for next time to further discuss this, for example, Dr. Caterino and Kathy's concerns about provisional licenses out of state?
To me, that is a moot point. Somebody who has a provisional license out of the state, they're applying here for an independent license. and they would fall on, I mean, they are brand new applicants. I don't think that even Kathy can advise people if they ask that, but it's not for the discussion needed.
Do you think that we will have anything different to say on, when it's an agenda item that we than what we've covered today?
I mean, I'd like to consider the option that Mr. Dina brought on the table when we have that as an agenda item, as a discussion consideration and possible action. It will also give us more time to, you know, to see if there's any pitfalls, further pitfalls.
Dr. Malott, with that, I would also request that when added to the agenda, that perhaps we receive copies of the letters that are provided both at the original time of application, and then if we do direct board staff today to send reminder letters that we have that material in front of us. Dr. Meyer?
But should we be making a decision on this if we're going to discuss it further? I mean,
it's not a decision. We've got
to postpone this or talk about it further, but I don't see why we need to talk about it further if we're going to issue any statement right now.
And Mike, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to.
We're not making a decision. We're just providing information as the statute currently reads.
Yeah, but. We don't want to send out a comment today, a position today, if we're going to then consciously say put it on the agenda next month, we might change that position. That makes us look really bad. So in my mind, so either, you know, I think we either go with this and we say extend out the letters, or if the consensus is we still want further discussion, we're not sure, then let's hold off on the letters until we have that discussion when it's properly agenda on the agenda.
And that will be in August too. We're skipping July. It'll be 2 months.
Are we skipping July?
Dr. Meyer.
So thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to further discuss this to try to bring Ms. Galvin around to our side and see our brilliant argument. But I think the legal side is clear. I think while we don't like the decision, I don't think we need to discuss it any further. I don't like this, but I think, can I make a motion about this, or are we?
No, it's not a motion. I don't know.
Ms. Shreve.
There's an agenda on our agenda. You can ask for items we've placed on. I think Dr. Malott can put the item on. I don't think we need a consensus to put an item on. Ms. Galvin can respond to that. But if we put the item on, we just need to address it. But if we do that, let's not send the letter out this month.
I agree. Or even respond to Dr. Blake's request.
Yeah.
If we're going to discuss it further.
But I agree. But my thoughts is I agree with Dr. Meyer. I'm not happy, but I think that the letter was pretty clear that was sent out to them. I think there isn't I don't think that we're going to be happy, because I think what legally we have is what we have. And we set something up, and they were notified in the letter that they originally received when they got their temporary license. So I don't think there's a change.
Ms. Pakenham.
I agree.
Members, I do need to call to your attention the statute. There is a provision at subsection B1 that the agency shall respond within 30 days of the receipt of the written request with a written clarification of its interpretation as raised in the request.
Well, we have to respond now.
Can we just say we're still looking?
We could ask Ms. Blake to waive that time period and allow the board to engage in further discussion.
Sorry, am I allowed to speak?
Yes.
Okay. I'm still a little bit confused about what exactly is happening. Are you all discussing whether or not ECPP Part 2 stands for us 25 folks, and that's what the extra time is needed for?
Well, and Ms. Galvin, you can correct me if I'm wrong. As it stands right now, the legal interpretation is that it does apply to you. The question is there further discussion for us to determine a way to effectively clarify means of previous dates that have been set forth and move forward with something that might remedy the potential situation of somebody assuming that it didn't apply to them. But that would require further discussion and before we could provide you a response as to whether or not it would apply.
I got it. Ms. Galvin, do we need a consensus to put it on the next agenda, or is Dr. Malott's request good enough? Because at that point, that decides where we go from here.
Yeah, I mean, this board is typically operated that if a board member has made a request for an agenda item to be placed, it occurs.
Okay, so if that's the case, then we, my suggestion is we put it on the next agenda. I mean, I think a lot of us, and then I guess what we'd need from Dr. Blake is your approval that you would waive the statute that says we have to get back with you within 30 days, because if we put this topic on the agenda, we won't be able to get back to you within 30 days. If we did, it would be a decision today. Are you okay with waiving that we can have additional time to look at this item?
Yes, I assume that, I guess that would be appropriate. I think it's important that maybe us 25 folks kind of know what we're up against sooner than later, so.
All right, so you're okay with, then we will then get back to you after our next meeting. All right, thank you.
And board staff would also be able to notify you of when the next meeting is and all that information so you can attend again as well. Dr. Meyer.
Well, we can respond to her saying, here's where we're at, right? I mean, Ms. Galvin, would that meet the 30 days? Is just to say, as the statute, we interpreted the statute this way. However, we're going to see if there's any alternative options
available to us.
Available. Is that a appropriate response within 30 days?
You could state to her that based on the board's consideration today, you would be subject to the ECCC part two. Further, the board has directed that it's going to, you know, have further discussion on this issue at a later board meeting that could, you know, alter the position that was rendered today.
I think that's so then there's no need to waive. I mean, I think that's really the way it stands today.
That's what Dr. Davies Wilson said anyway to her.
Right.
And we need the resuscitation paddles taken to Ms. Galvin's office.
You're the closest.
All right. Are there any additional questions or comments at this time?
So staff will draft this letter to Dr. Blake regarding its current interpretation, understanding that it's up for additional discussion and a future agenda.
Excellent. And we're not sending anything out to others.
Correct. Dr. Blake, did you have any additional questions? I saw you raised your hand.
Thank you. I think Ms. Galvin might have addressed my question. What I was going to ask is, since this discussion is essentially being tabled, that doesn't mean that someone in my position might have the chance of not having to take part two. Essentially, that is a given. I will have to take part two. Is that correct?
As it stands now, yes.
Okay.
All right. Any other discussion? All right. Hearing none, I would like to, because we don't need a motion on the case, I would like to propose a comfort break. All righty. If we want to do, let's do 15 minutes and resume at 11:10. Perfect. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would like to go ahead and give out the next CE code word for anybody attending for CE.
The next CE code word is ice cream. Ice cream.
Okay, you can't say a code word like that.
Yeah.
And not have like some treats that were all delivered to our house or something. Oh man, that sounds good.
Something next time.
All right, and just to confirm, do we have Mr. Diner, have you returned?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm here.
Thank you. And Dr. Malott.
I'm here.
Perfect. Then we will proceed. We are on agenda item number 11. Ms. Pacman, would you please provide a summary of this item to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm happy to.
Oh, hold on 1 second, Dr. Meyer.
I need to recuse myself from this item.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Pacman.
Thank you. Yes, I'm sure you're eager to have more discussion about the EPPP as this agenda item reflects. We received a request from ASPA, the Arizona Psychological Association, and essentially what they're requesting would be approval to allow applicants for psychologist licensure by examination to take the EPPP upon completion of their doctoral coursework and prior to completion of the required dissertation and the required internship. And I believe in considering this request, you're going to need to look at the statute 32-2072 examinations exemptions at subsection C. It seems that that language encompasses or describes the education requirements as encompassing the dissertation and internship requirements, and 32-2071 recognizes as such. So it seems that we may need to look at that language and that a revision to 32-2072 at C might be in order. But before we get ahead of ourselves, Dr. Flint, who's representing ASPA, is here today to summarize this request and maybe share the association's thoughts relative to how this request should be implemented or whether it should be implemented.
Thank you. Ms. Shreve?
Ms. Pacanen, could you give those citations again really but slowly, right? So I'm trying to pull them up on the book. 32.
Yes. So 32-2072 establishes the examination requirement.
Okay.
The one just prior to it, 32-2071, outlines the qualifications of applicant education and training.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Flint, thank you for joining us. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and then providing us a summary of ASPA's recommendation or request, that would be excellent.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me. I'm Melissa Flint. I'm a licensed psychologist here in Arizona. In full disclosure, I also work full-time at Midwestern University, in addition to being the ASPA board liaison. This early entry option, and that's the wording used by ASPPB, would allow Arizona students to take just the part one following their doctoral coursework. There was a suggestion by UA to word it as upon completion of core graduate coursework, which nobody on the memo was opposed to. We know that for our students, the longer they wait, the more difficult it is to pass. And then there's other fees and there's extra studying time and delay to get jobs. And they've already completed this arduous journey of getting a degree that is very costly in a lot of cases. This would allow us to kind of follow suit with some of our medical school colleagues who take their knowledge exams while they're in school and then do the skills exam, which are equivalent now as the EPPP Part 2, once the degree's done. Another part of this, as we're trying to look at barriers to licensure in our state, there's a couple of different things. The cost alone for anybody, when you look at the average salary of people who are in internship and postdoc, asking them to take two rather expensive tests, even though they've tried to make it not as much within a close time frame, is kind of illogical. Our students struggle with this a lot. And then what's the impact on students who are marginalized or underrepresented in any way? It just seems like it's a barrier to licensure that maybe we could take down by really thinking through this issue and seeing if this is a possibility. I just want to make sure everybody understands that this changes nothing with regards to the timing of actual licensure. It just moves up that opportunity to take the EPPP Part 1 in a clearer time frame to when they've actually had the classes. And then they go out and they do their internship, they learn a lot more skills, and then we test them for skills. So it kind of makes sense in the flow. I did not put this in the memo, I just realized, but I did speak extensively with Matt Turner and at ASPPB, and he, of course, feels ASPPB very much supports this. And I did take time to get with the major stakeholders and see how they felt about it. And that was outlined in the memo. So ASPA absolutely supports this as really looking at a taking down yet another barrier to licensure, basically financial. Selfishly, as an educator, if our students are able to take it a little bit earlier, I can also step in and help them if anybody's having trouble. Once they get kind of out of our program, there might not be a lot of communication. So I think there's lots of benefits to this. We weren't really able to identify any barriers in the conversations that I had with stakeholders. Certainly there's other pieces that might come up that we just haven't thought about. But we thought this was an important piece to maybe make this process a little less arduous for some of our student clinicians as they join the ranks in our state.
Thank you. Board members, do you have questions for Dr. Flint?
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with this process for counselors who are allowed to take the exam upon certification by an academic program, because you still need somebody because they don't have the requisite. I'm not against the proposal. I think taking the exam closer to when you've taken coursework will help increase pass rates. But I am concerned about process. And because the students haven't been vetted, they don't have a degree, you know, there's lots and lots of things we look at. Process is really critical. Even before we consider such a proposal, we have to have the process outlined. I don't know how other entities like PA, I know the Physician's Assistant program, you can take the exam while you're still a student in the program. Counselors, you can. And we do it directly with the agency that administers the exam. So it's a direct process and they work with the universities. And actually the board is not involved in that process. The only thing that the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners does is they accept the exam score, whether you take it through them, you know, like people come and apply for license, or you take it directly through NBCC, and those exam scores are then shared with the board. So the board has, the national board that administers the exam has created this process allowing students, and then states have the choice to accept the exam or not. So I'm really curious as to other states who may do this early entry option and how that is administered. And I would need that information before we could discuss that further. So,
Madam Chair, can I provide at least a partial answer to Dr. Malott's question?
Yes.
I am looking, Dr. Malott, at the report from ASPPB's new Center for Data and Analysis and Psychologist Licensure. And so far, what I'm able to discern is that the question has been posed of the jurisdictions relative to early permissions to take the examination. And I'm happy to send this to you, but it appears that there's one jurisdiction that permits ECCC to sit for the ECCC during the graduate year. So that's one during the graduate year, 15 after degree granted, 7 during the postdoctoral training, 3 upon completion of all supervised work experience, and then there's sort of a category called other where 10 jurisdictions responded to that. And I'm happy to gather, you know, go into that data a little deeper for you.
Then I think it would be the early entry. We used to require our exam post-supervision. We changed it to post, now that you can take, you know, you can do it without meeting the supervision. I'm really actually interested in the process. How does one verify somebody's credentials while they're still a student? The academic program would be heavily involved. So I'm just curious about any, you know, precedent in terms of process, who verifies, if somebody does not pass the exam, and, you know, starts their internship, does not pass the exam again, starts their, you know, would it impact their ability to get an internship? Of course, it would be an option. Students don't have to do it. So I just think we need more information. So.
Additional questions or comments from the board members? Ms. Shreve?
I was going to say, I like the concept in the sense it makes sense. You're getting out of school. And then now that we have the, through each of P part two, which is more practical as opposed to, curriculum focused. I mean, it does kind of make sense in some ways. So I think it's definitely worth the discussion. And Dr. Malott, you're right. You know, getting some more information, but I like, you know, conceptually, it sounds like it makes sense.
Dr. Caterino?
I think it does make sense. And at one point I was speaking to the former head of ASPPB who encouraged people to take the master's. There were two or three states that allowed you to be a psychologist at the master's level with the EPPP. And he encouraged people to have their students take the test in those states and then transfer to Arizona or their home state. So And it made sense. I think it does make sense. It's closer to their coursework. I think it'd be fine. So,
thank you. Additional comments? Dr. Carroll?
It sounds like a good idea, and I think process is important. How the universities handle this seems to be pretty critical. Do you have any opinions, Dr. Flint, about how to approach part two? Should that be after the internship?
Yes, we're not asking for any time frame deviation on what you've already decided for the part two. That would be after degree conferral, after internship, you know, when they kind of apply for their independent licensure.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Shreve?
Just to confirm, then this would require a statutory change, Ms. Pathanon?
Madam Chair, Ms. Shreve, I believe that is the case. I would invite Ms. Galvin to take a look at that as well. But I think what we're looking at is because one statute describes completing all educational requirements as inclusive of the dissertation and all training. I think that's the piece that's the hang up.
I would agree.
Ms. Pakanan, I'll be willing to work with you, as we delve into the process and look at that, because I'm very familiar with at least the process for the National Board Counselor and how the university certifies. I used to be in charge of that process. I'm very interested in the process, because I don't want us to get in trouble with the process, and it needs to be really spelled out. So,
certainly. Thank you. So other than kind of further investigation and information gathering, is there anything else that we as a board need to do today related to this matter?
Madam Chair, I'll share my thoughts if you'd like to hear them. I think what we're talking about is, you know, some additional information gathering, and then this will be on a future meeting agenda. Since there's an acknowledgement that a statutory change is very likely necessary, then I think a future conversation will need to focus on, you know, what does that look like? Is that something that ASPA is advancing? Is it something that ASPA and the board are working on together? We will just need to, you know, make certain that our roles and our, you know, commitment or neutrality or whatever our position is clear at some point in the future.
Well, thank you. Any other comments on this matter? All right. Hearing none, thank you, Dr. Flint, for that summary, and we'll continue to keep you in the loop of where we are in talking about it. And as Dr. Malott and Ms. Pakanon explore more information, we'll make sure to keep you in the loop of what we're doing as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and any help that I can be, please reach out.
Thank you. All right, we will now move to agenda item number 12. Ms. Pakanon, would you please provide the board a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. I had previously indicated that I would provide a final summary of legislative action for the almost completed legislative session to this board. The legislature has recessed, and hopefully before June 30th, they will complete the final work on the final bills, which of course are the budget bills. They've been introduced, but there are some provision of those bills where they aren't quite finalized. But having said that, all the legislation that we have been meticulously following through the process, they've all either been signed by the governor or have, you know, were simply allowed to die. And so that detailed report is included in my memorandum. But what I really wanted to do was highlight the statute changes, the legislation that compels staff to change something or to implement something, just so you can have a sense of, you know, what the impact was from some of these bills. And there are really only four of them. And I apologize, the first one, copy paste error on my part. What I'm describing on line one is clearly the board's bill. So Senate Bill 1253, I put the wrong title there. But of course, we will need to implement those provisions. They're well understood. It's legislation that we worked on for over 2 years. The most notable, of course, is the fingerprint card clearance requirements beginning January 1 of 2022. We've already implemented the piece about the Argosy students, that session law that gives them a window of time to apply and be eligible for licensure. And then the other provisions of that bill, we will just sort of address them as cases or situations present. Any questions about the first one, Senate Bill 1253? Okay, then of course, House Bill 2561, this board had decided to support the PCSAS accreditation change to the statutes. Really, all that requires is, you know, just making sure that our applications reflect as such. The statute language will change 90 days after the conclusion of the session. So, you know, we'll of course make sure that any reference to accreditation points to the correct statute language. Any questions about that change? Okay, then moving on to Senate Bill 1149, we just need to make sure that the addition of the word shall is included with any reference to the universal recognition application. I think that's fairly straightforward. Let me know if you have any questions about that. Okay, and then of course the final piece of legislation, which will require probably the heaviest level of effort, would be implementing the registry, the out-of-state practice registry that this bill creates. There will have to be an application process, and of course, the applications will need to be presented to the respective committees and to the board. So we have really no sense at this time what we're looking at in terms of numbers for the out-of-state practice registry. Some of the things that we're looking at to try to quantify this would include the rapid expansion of SIPACT. There will be some 30 states soon that will be participating in that interstate compact. So by virtue of that opportunity, this may render the out-of-state practice registry for some psychologists as not quite as appealing as SIPACT, because SIPACT has a much broader reach. So that is something that, you know, we're sort of, you know, contemplating that we may not see registrant applicants coming from states that are participating in SciPact. However, there are certain states like California, like Colorado, Oregon, Washington, they are not currently participating in SciPact. And so we're trying to ascertain how many of those licensees may want to practice via telehealth into Arizona. And to inform us, we're going to analyze the data from our temporary license applicants. We have some 600 licensees, both psychologists and behavior analysts, who have applied for and been granted that temporary emergency license under the Department of Health Services waiver opportunity. Once the emergency is lifted, those temporary licenses will be terminated, as the order states. They will have an opportunity through the exemption language, as we've talked about, to try to finish up and transfer any care. But those individuals may be very interested in now applying through the registry. I know I've shared a lot of information with you, so maybe I'll stop there and see if there are any questions.
Are there any questions by board members?
Just one other point of clarification too, of course, the behavior analysts do not have an interstate compact at this time. We do have a very small number of behavior analysts who have applied for the emergency temporary license. So I don't see that impact as being particularly big at this time. However, over time, it may grow because there isn't an alternative strategy for them to practice across state borders.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Peckman? Hearing none, you may continue.
That actually, that's my summary. I just wanted to make certain again that, you know, the board sort of understands that there are some, you know, some significant policy shifts that are happening, whether we're talking about, you know, the fingerprint card clearance requirement, you know, accreditation changes, and especially the registry. So that will have implications for your roles and your future agendas.
Thank you. All right. Hearing no further questions, I'm pulling back up my notes. We are now on agenda item 13, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding out-of-state telehealth practice registry exempt rulemaking. Ms. Pacnon, would you please provide the board a summary of this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm going to be asking the board to provide some direction relative to this matter. So just sort of segueing from the earlier explanation of House Bill 2454 and the creation of the out-of-state practice registry, there's a provision in that bill that exempts for 1 year rulemaking requirements by the agencies who need to make rule changes. And so what that means is that the requirements of the Administrative Procedures Act, as it relates to everything that we need to do to promulgate a rule, those are lifted for 1 year. So we are moving very quickly to propose the rules or to implement rule changes. And of course, the rule changes need to address the registry fee and also the registry timeframes. I know I presented these in a specific order on the memo. I started out with the fees and then moved to the time frame recommendations. I'd like to flip the order a little bit because some recent information that emerged yesterday, I think it's going to modify or change what I'm about to ask you and what I'm going to explain. So if you will, scroll to the second page of my memorandum, where I recommend that the timeframes in our rules for the out-of-state practice registry be entirely consistent with that for the other license types. And I think the reason for that is pretty clear. We don't want to have timeframes that deviate from those that are established and that we have followed for probably a few decades. If we did, it would necessitate, you know, different tracking, many more meetings. It would just be, it would be very cumbersome to try to track and comply with. So I think it makes complete sense that our timeframes for the out-of-state registry processing of those applications be consistent with all other applications. Is that, hopefully that's clear, but I'm happy to answer any questions or explain that better if you need me to.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Peckman or any comments on the information she's provided us? I mean, I think the recommendations are well established, and appreciate the work that you put forth in them, that you and staff put forth, and even in making sure to provide that rationale as to why those decisions are being made.
Yes, ma'am, I'm sure you're very welcome. I'm obviously timeframes impact not only the staff from an administrative timeframe processing perspective, but it's also going to impact you, board members and committee members, in your respective roles. So I guess what I'm suggesting is, you know, just be prepared that this registry is going to, you know, create, you know, many, many more applications to review. And that's just something that I think we need to be prepared for it, and maybe think about some potential solutions down the road if, you know, this really becomes a daunting amount of work. You know, it's anybody's guess. So, but before I get ahead of myself, maybe I'll move on then to the other clarification that is needed on page 2 of my memorandum. What I should have explained earlier is that we are working with Jeannie Han on this rulemaking. You've met Ms. Han on a number of occasions in the past. She's been engaged to sort of, you know, guide us through the Byzantine process of rule promulgating. What she has identified is that so telehealth is now the standard term or the consistent term that House Bill 2454 is using to refer to telemedicine, telepractice, and so forth. So it's trying to arrive at, you know, a consistency in how it's described. So because our definition of telepractice refers to telehealth or equates telepractice with telehealth, I think we are okay with using telehealth in our rulemaking, even though we sort of have this definition of telepractice. I don't think that's a problem. Ms. Han doesn't think that's a problem, but if the board feels differently, then we need to talk about that.
And the telepractice is, it appears in definition to be applicable to psychologists. If we used the word telepractice, we would still almost have to include both to capture behavior analysts as well.
I do not know if we have telepractice defined in the behavior analyst statutes.
I don't think we do.
I don't think we do.
But that we probably need that in there somehow. And given that Access is extending that benefit through licensed professionals, which includes behavior analysts, we would need to get that inserted.
Yes, Madam Chair, I agree with Dr. Davey. So the by virtue of the use of telehealth in the new statute that is 36-3606, then it does encompass all of the professions under that umbrella, but it would be ideal for us to, you know, clean up our own statute language to be entirely consistent.
Excellent, thank you. Any additional comments, questions, guidance for Ms. Pakanon?
This is Dr. Malott.
Dr. Malott.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because names have a way of changing, if we could say equivalent, you know, something, because what if it changes in a year and there's a new trendy term and we have to go through statute changes for a definition, which you know, we want to avoid that as much as possible. So.
You might be able to say something like telehealth or telepractice as defined in, and then reference that statute to give us a little bit of cover.
Yeah.
If there were a change. Hopefully this is, there won't be now that they've kind of settled on the telehealth.
Yeah. I agree.
Yes, Madam Chair, I know a broad coalition of stakeholders worked on this legislation, and telehealth was the term that they arrived at. But to Dr. Malott's point, I think that there's going to be sort of this, depending on, you know, what language preexisted or, you know, just sort of mostly what language that we're presented with or that exists in our statutes and rules. I think different professions are going to probably use terms that are meant to be equivalent to telehealth. And so, you know, that consistency process is probably going to take some time. So I need to train myself because I may use, you know, three different terms and mean the same thing. So if we're ready to move on to the fees decisions. So what I had originally recommended was that the initial fee for the registration be consistent with that of the initial application fees that we currently charge. And the rationale for that was simply because it's assumed that we're going to incur the same level of effort, the same amount of work to receive an application, intake an application, review it for administrative completeness, bring it to the respective committee. The committee performs its review, then the board and so forth. So in the absence of any other data, the only recommendation at which I could arrive is let's be consistent and charge the same fee, because what the outcome is an authorization to practice in Arizona. So I am not sure I'm still convinced that fee is appropriate, because the other piece to this is that Ms. Han had assumed that this legislation authorizes the boards who are implementing the registry. We are authorized to charge a annual renewal fee. I wasn't convinced that the language does that. And Ms. Galvin informed me yesterday that we are going to receive an opinion from the Attorney General's office that we don't, in fact, have the authority to charge an annual registration fee, in spite of the fact that the registrants are required to register annually and assumedly provide us with updated information. What this means is that there's only one opportunity for us to collect a fee to try to recoup the costs that we incur with processing applications, reviewing them, granting them, and renewing them. So I am not certain that $350 is reflective of the cost of someone registering, filing a registration and renewing that registration potentially in perpetuity. Does that make sense?
Yes. Any comments, Dr. Catarino?
Well, and the renewal form, which I just paid yesterday, is $500. So it seems that they should, and that required to me maybe less work than the initial check. So I thought maybe $350 was low.
Well, and what I neglected to say was that Ms. Galvin thinks that we shouldn't charge $1 million for the application fee for the registration. So let's just sort of remember that.
I was thinking that the $500 maybe. Yeah.
I was thinking $1 million that then we would go alphabetically and distribute that to board members.
Yeah. Good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We need to go then on some trips, retreats. Yes.
What you do with the money is up to you. I think it's just.
So, Ms. Pakkinen, the registration process, would it be very similar? They'd have to do three letters of recommendation, you know, all of, or would it be more like a universal application, or is it a national kind of a, you know?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, Dr. Malott. And I can do sort of a crosswalk if, at some point, just to sort of map the requirements of initial licensure or an unrestricted license to the registry. There's a great deal of divergence. You cited, you know, references and so forth. That is not, we're not authorized to collect a lot of that type of information with the registry. It is more congruent to the universal recognition application process. I do see some similarities between the registry and universal recognition. What I can think of without referring back to the legislation, some new requirements or some requirements that are unique to the registry include providing malpractice, proof of malpractice insurance, and insurance that enables that person to practice in Arizona. That may be something that has a chilling effect on some individuals' desire to practice via telehealth in Arizona. I don't know that for certain. The other requirement that is unique to this registry that I can think of immediately is the a statutory agent needs to be identified in this state for purposes of us providing notice to that person of, you know, a possible investigation or something of that nature. So what is not clear to me and is included in a lengthy list of questions that have been shared with Jean, would be questions like, can we ask about, you know, the professional conduct questions, the good moral character kinds of questions. Are those also, are we authorized to present those and require those for the registrants? The other question is the fingerprint clearance card. Once that goes into effect January 1, are our registrants also subject to that requirement? So there's a lot of questions for which we are waiting for a lot of answers.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I think with all, because for me, trying to figure out the cost is going to be dependent on, obviously, the workload. And I do have concerns about just doing the 500, knowing that every year there's additional tasks being tasked to staff that wouldn't necessarily be captured in that initial fee. But to tell what would require an understanding of, you know, to Dr. Malott's question of what all is going to go into the application processes and verifications and things like that that'll be necessary. I also want us to consider and maybe talk about at a later time that we have done, you know, quite well with the budget. And we have talked about reduction in fees in other areas and perhaps justification for why we would keep this at a lower fee. I mean, $500 is consistent, but it's not $500 every 2 years. So it's significantly a lower fee. Could be, you know, avenues at which we would be potentially getting resources to rural communities, because this would give us that ability in those urban, you know, communities in the Phoenix and Tucson area. All of the, you know, it's kind of oversaturated markets and nobody is providing those rural areas the telehealth, especially when you've got states like New Mexico that have really strong telehealth networks. If they have the staff and the bandwidth to be able to send people over to provide on the reservations and what have you, like they're already doing in New Mexico, that could give some rationale because we could be serving some underserved communities. But I think the answer is to what that application fee should be would be dependent on the answers that we get along the way.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I think something to keep in mind, this is just the initial fee setting process. So we have this opportunity through this exempt rulemaking to get the fees in place, to get the timeframes in place. over time, we may be able to sort of revisit this and well, my assignment would be to analyze what are our costs associated with implementing the registry. And it may be that 2 years from now, we're having a conversation that sounds like, you know what, the cost of this registry is quite excessive. And so we need to revisit these fees. Or maybe the converse would be true. You know, it really has not been the kind of, you know, level of effort that we were possibly concerned about. So we could lower the fee. So this fee won't be with us forever. I do want us to be, you know, as thoughtful as we can be setting this fee from the onset, even in the absence of information and data that we wish that we had.
So with that, then, are you looking for hopefully a more solidified fee at this meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am. We really need to get that information to Ms. Hand so she can start, you know, filing the rules. And we're working on this immediately, right out of the gate. I know we're ahead of other agencies, and I'm pleased about that, but I really don't want to waste any time. And also, curiously, we haven't received any inquiries yet about the registry. I think what we've heard is that some of the temporary license holders, the emergency temporary license holders, they're curious about what happens next, but I haven't had anyone say, when is the registry open? When can I register? But we need to anticipate that those questions are going to start coming. And so the sooner that we can tell people who are interested, potential applicants, you know, here's when we intend to have it ready. You know, here's the intake process. Here's the cost. I think that's ideal.
Well, I mean, you know, because it might just be a one-time fee, I think going slightly higher than the current application fee is probably wise. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a few individual practitioners who may decide to go that route, but a lot of mega corporations are going to be pursuing, you know, they're going to be getting their licensed psychologists on the registry in many states. And I've already seen, you know, people have been accessing those services. And what happens with complaints? Who gets to hear the complaint?
Madam Chair, Dr. Malat, I think there are a lot of questions around that too, some of which we've forwarded to Ms. Galvin, and I know are currently being reviewed within their section. I have a concern that maybe the legislation doesn't quite give this board full authority to investigate concerns. I'm concerned that maybe the jurisdiction isn't quite as present as it would be for those who are, you know, licensed by our jurisdiction. So those are only my concerns, and I don't know, you know, until we get some sort of response or clarification from the Attorney General's office, I feel I'm ill-equipped to answer that.
And we hope to have that memo out by the middle of next week.
Okay. But thank you for raising it. It's definitely something that, especially as you would imagine, Jennifer and I have had some conversations about, and more questions than answers.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Diner.
Thank you. So I think, I mean, in terms of the fees question, my rule of thumb is, we don't probably want to give preferential treatment to out-of-staters, and we don't want to discriminate against out-of-staters either. So with that in mind, I think any fee structure that is above or below the fee structure for Arizona licenses would be problematic in my mind. Does that make sense?
And Mr. Jenner, I agree with you. I think that the kicker is that the current fee structure is $350 for initial, $500 for application, $500 for initial, and then $500 for every renewal, and that's every 2 years. This group is going to have to essentially renew annually, but with no fees associated. And so there's costs associated in their updating of the registry and their testing to the information every year. While they might be lesser costs than an entire reapplication, I think the argument could be made that there would need to be a little bit of a different fee associated with that initial, given that let's say we look at it, you know, myself, I've been licensed since 2010, right? So I'm on 11 years at 12 years, every 2 years, that's, you know, what, 6 renewals at $500 a piece. And so my licensure costs are upwards at $4,000 already to continue to practice in the state. If I lived out of state, my only cost would be $850. And so that would be the piece that we would have to figure out, because you're right. I completely agree with you. I just think that the fee structure has to look different, and that's really hard to do. Cause yeah, I've been practicing for 10 years, but somebody else may practice for 2 years and then get a full-time university job and never, you know, and never practice again with their current company or what have you. And so that cost would look different. And that's the hard part to capture.
Why is it that we can't have a renewal fee like $250 each year? Is there some reason?
Ms. Galvin, do you want to field that question? I think that the language does not, because it uses a term other than renewal, I think it's update your registry. And so update has a different legal meaning than renewal.
I would agree.
So that does that mean you cannot charge for updates the way we pay for renewals?
It's a mandatory annual update. So it's not like a change in address where I change my, you know, I update the board with information as needed. It would be that and that would be what creates more work, is that everybody would have to update the board annually with either there's changes or there's no changes, which creates work for the board. And I think one of the things that comes to mind for me when it comes to workload is, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that notices, the extensive hours that board staff are already working. They are already working late nights all week long. We're getting emails on weekends. I mean, they're working a lot of hours. And yes, we've been able to get, you know, another, you know, part-time licensure help, but this is adding to their workload as well. And so we have to make sure that we budget in such a way that if needed, we would be able to add potentially additional staff folks to cover the, you know, additional workload that's coming from this. And so I'm wondering, because it's not set, and obviously we're missing information and we really don't have projections as to, like, I would imagine that initially there would be, you know, more psychologists than behavior analysts, but who knows? Like, we have zero projections as to, like, what this would look like. And so I'm wondering if that higher fees, you know, whether it's $750 or $1,000, just to make the statement of there's a difference in how these are processed and there's a difference in costs, but then we could reevaluate it once we had that data to say, like, the process really doesn't take that much extra time, or, you know, so maybe we reduce it, or maybe it needs to increase based on data that we have, because we need to justify a full-time staff member for it or what have you. I'm afraid that if we just do the $500 and we make it consistent, that people might assume that consistency without understanding the renewal process and the lack of fees associated with their updates. So I'm wondering, and I don't want to break the bank on people, and I get that. I'm with Dr. Malat. I think this is going to open the doors for a lot of large corporations.
Yes.
Who would be interested in this market. Now, I don't want it to come across that we're charging more because, you know, we're making assumptions that they could pay more. That's by no means what I mean. But at the same time, I don't want it to be so much so that we flood the gates and we have no means of supporting board staff through getting, you know, through those applications.
Madam Chair, can I respond to some of the things? Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to mention, like, how can they justify fairness when they don't ever have to renew and people in Arizona do? They only have that one time fee, and we have, just like she said, we have fees every 2 years. Doesn't seem fair to me.
Ms. Packnum?
Might as well move out of state and just continue to get licensed as an out-of-state practitioner.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just to explain, the update requirements includes submitting a list of patient contacts. It may or may not, this is one of our many questions, may or may not also include, you know, updating the, insurance. Presumably it would, because insurance policies have a beginning and an end, an expiration date. So that's additional information that's coming to us. So it will be labor every single renewal. So I'm sorry, update. I can't use the term renewal. One of the things that I want to say too is that I am so relieved that we are shifting to a different management system for our agency and our, you know, business processes, including application processing, because what I'm confident about is that the new system will be able to generate the kind of data points that we will need to be looking at 2 years from now. So, you know, in terms of where did these people come from, you know, what were the, how many touch points did we have with those individuals in the process? And so that's really going to be incredibly useful as we make future decisions, which may be a departure from the decisions that you're being asked to make today. I can also, final comment, tell you that what I am already anticipating, though, is that the projections, the data that we do have, I think that this part-time position that we have been tentatively almost approved for, it's almost assuredly going to grow into a full-time position. And so I expect submitting justification for the appropriation to increase to reflect that. Unfortunately, we could not increase that half-time position to that level until a year from now.
This is Dr. Malat. I was just looking at the National Register. They do have a renewal fee of $200. Unless you're a new psychologist, it's $150. If you're military, it's $100. Emeritus, who are no longer licensed, have a fee too, and $225. But they have a renewal fee. To me, 500 sounds like a middle up the road, and then we can reevaluate in a couple of years or in a year, depending on the traffic we get. I'm sure there's concern from people who want to be on different registries. You know, they could end up paying, if they're on 10 states, national, you know, the registry, it could cost them $5,000. But if it's a one-time, it could flood our markets. So, but I think starting out with 500, not knowing the landscape, might be the safest. You know, it's a little higher than the initial application fee, but it's not so unreasonable, you know, so.
And Madam Chair, Dr. Malat, what it does do too, is it gives us a little bit of, enhances our ability to, you know, build new modules in the online system too, which isn't inexpensive. So I do think that we need to not only keep the manpower costs in mind, but also the technology costs. And, you know, unfortunately, I just can't say this enough, the additional time that all of you as essentially volunteers will have to invest in this process. And unfortunately, there isn't much that we can do to address, you know, that. But it's just going to be a whole lot more work for you as volunteers.
Dr. Malott, you're talking the raise the $350 application fee to $500?
Not raise. We're setting a new fee for this group. So it will be a $500 application fee to be on the registry.
Perfect. Yes. But that would be, that differs from the proposal we have before us. And I think that that would.
Oh, I'm sorry. What do we have?
I thought maybe.
Let me look again.
Maybe I misread it. Let me double check as well.
Well, it's under the old. This is assuming that we would get to charge renewals, right? So.
Right. So the application fee is $350 with the, you know, proposal to charge $500 for renewals, but because we wouldn't be able to charge renewals, then we would be essentially proposing $500 instead of the $350.
Madam Chair, that is correct. So the copy or the draft that Ms. Han forwarded, so if you're looking at this is page 7 of your document, the R426108, the proposed insertion of language at subsection B, it would be new subsection B, there would only be, we're only authorized to charge at B1. So Jeannie's draft insertion at B2, we are not authorized to include.
Yeah, so my concern is that, again, if for a state licensed behavior analyst, you know, working 3 years in the state, it's what, $1,350, the $350 for initial license and the, or for application, $500 for initial license and $500 for renewal. Whereas someone on this registry working in the state would only be at $500 for all 3 years. Just given an example.
So are you recommending a higher amount, Dr. Wilson?
I'm kind of where you are, Dr. Malott, in that I'm not comfortable with just making up an arbitrary number. My only concern is, well, my question is, so there's the application fee and then there's the licensure fee, right? So if I'm a brand new licensee, it's a total of $850 for me to get licensed in Arizona. And so I would propose at a minimum that they also pay that $850, for that initial.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm okay with that. I think that makes sense. That has a logic to it. I mean, it could even go up to $1,000 since there's no renewal fee.
And that was kind of my thought. So my concern, Dr. Malott, with just doing the $850 is, if the numbers were to come in 2 years from now and it be decided that that number need to be raised, would there be a feeling or argument or assumption that there is some sort of discrimination happening with that group? Whereas if we have it slightly different to begin with, could that maybe inadvertently send that message that there's additional work related to this group that is different, captured differently than the other. And so I would propose 1,000. But Dr. Davey has his hands raised, and then hand raised, and then Dr. Meyer.
So I agree, like coming up with an arbitrary number seems a little bit awkward. Do we have data of kind of like what the average lifetime, lifetime value of a licensee is? Like how many renewals does our average licensee go through? So if someone comes through to the state of Arizona, becomes licensed, are they with us for 10 years, 12 years? And then at least you have
30 years.
30 years. Yeah. I'm guessing we've got some on either side of that, right?
44.
But at least you would have a frame of reference of like the average psychologist tenure or licensure tenure in the state is, let's just say 10 years to make it easy. And someone who practiced 10 years that lived in state, their fees would be X. And that way you'd have an argument of like, this is how we came to this number. You know, fine, there's going to be someone who exits after 2 years, but there's going to be someone who stays for 30. At least you'd have some sort of argument to back it up, would be my suggestion.
Well, and Dr. Davey, I had very similar thoughts, but my concern would then go to accessibility of clients and increase in other fees that would be associated with just telehealth delivery that could, I'm not saying it would, but could make a difference as to whether or not. So I don't want to also discourage people from doing it because they're not going to have, especially if they have a practice across multiple states, that they're not going to have enough states to justify the practice in Arizona. If they're not going to get.
I don't think that's not really our problem. Our hands are tied based on what was passed. And we were told that, you know, essentially it's this fee, like we get a chance at one fee. Like we weren't given the latitude to have that renewal piece in there and actually operate this correctly. And quite honestly, my opinion is we're working within the parameters we were given. Do I wish they were different? They are, but I do, but they're not. So I think we have to answer the question that we've been given. And that is, what do you think you're going to charge given this fact that this is almost a singular charge for a lifetime of administrative work by our board?
Yeah, I agree. Dr. Meyer.
So a couple of concerns. I understand what you're saying, but first of all, this was written to say that we're not doing renewals. And so I do have a little bit of concern about saying, well, since we don't get to charge for renewals, then we're going to get all that money in at the very beginning. I think in part that's going against what this law is, similar to our complaints about the universal recognition. There's issues with that, but that's what we needed to do. And so I'm a little hesitant to say, let's figure out what this would cost for the lifetime of it and charge that. The second concern is if we go too high, most psychologists aren't going to be able to afford to do this or behavior analysts. I mean, when I was starting out, it was tough to just afford my one state license. And so if we put this too far out of reach, I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot when we do need more service provision, especially in rural areas.
I don't discount what you're saying, Dr. Meyer. I think my concern is that what we've been handed puts our backs against the wall, right? Either we let everybody in on a one-time fee and we say, yep, we're just going to suck this up. And those that are in state and have renewals, we're going to figure out some way to have their fees cover these other people's fees. You know, we really weren't given good options. I don't want to limit access. Access is a huge issue to, you know, the families that we serve and the state of Arizona. But the rules that are put in front of us don't give us very many options. And I agree, the front loading of fees is horrible, right? They can get to charge somebody $1,000. But we have no real way of saying, well, we're going to charge you $200 every 2 years. We weren't given that option. So I hear what you're saying. And please know that I'm not I don't disagree with anything you said, but I think we were handed a certain box that we have to operate in, and it's not the box we want to be in. And I don't know how to get out of it.
And I'm gonna
we can revisit this in a year. I mean, we take our best stab here, probably erring on the low side for 1 year and see where that puts us. Or, I mean, do we even have to wait a year? At what point could we adjust this once we start seeing people coming in and figuring out what this is going to cost? But right now we have a surplus, and weren't we considering lowering fees anyway? So if we're overcharging here, I think that's the worst route to go.
Dr. Meyer, I'm going to turn it to Mr. Diner. He's been waiting patiently. Mr. Diner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when I was looking at the fee structure that we have, and when I was looking at the telehealth statute or telepractice statute, what occurs to me is is kind of equivalent to an application. So the statute told us, the legislature told us, we can charge an application fee for Arizonans who want to get licensed. And now the telepractice statute tells us we can charge a registration fee. Now our board statutes tell us we can charge renewal fees, but the telepractice statute tells us we can't charge any fees after registration. So as an applicant, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, registration is equal to application. So given kind of the rule of thumb I have in mind, no favorable treatment, no discrimination, I would think a registration fee that's the same as an application fee makes sense to me. And that's it. I mean, we don't have an option. The legislature told us not to charge any fees beyond registration fees. That's not a choice we have. At least that's how I'm thinking of this issue. So $350 would be sort of the figure in my mind, because that's the application fee for an active psychology license.
Dr. Caterino.
What about the $850 as we talked about before? Because that's the first that's year the and then the initial application.
That's the renewal. 2 year renewal fees, $500.
No,
and we can't charge renewal.
No, that's the first year in the application.
Yeah, Dr. Caterina, Ms. Pecknon or Ms. Folks, if you guys could clarify, because I'm pretty sure to become initially licensed, it's $850.
Yes, Madam Chair. So we have it's two transactions, which is not always the case. Not all boards have two transactions associated with the granting of a license. So we have in rule a application fee. And then once the application is approved and licensure is approved by this board, then a prorated fee is charged to that individual for the granting of the license. I think, this is my speculation, I think that is a reflection of from some time ago, perhaps decades ago, where those two transactions appropriately reflected the cost of processing the application and issuing the license. I don't know that that is still the case. It's one of the fees that I would really like for this board to revisit someday. But yes, we do have the $500 plus the prorated $350, depending on the timing of the grant of the license.
Madam Chair, if I may add to that?
Oops, yes.
The license issuance fee, based on the way the rules are written, is they're paying $20.83 a month for the license. They're basically paying for the months they're going to hold the license for that initial period. And it's prorated based on the number of months they hold it until it expires, until the expiration date, which, as we know, is based on your birth month now, and whether or not your license number is odd or even.
Dr. Meyer.
So that would mean it's closer to $250 for that first year, right? It's $500 covers 2 years or prorated. Mm-hmm. So it'd be the $350 application, the $250 for a year. So $600 is what it costs to be licensed for 1 year, mm-hmm. or that first year.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but here's my problem with that. The problem is when they're with the new registration system, we aren't granting them a license. So we are adding apples and oranges in my mind. So application equals registration, and then granting of a license, we just aren't granting a license to these people. So
well, but if we're not
I'm not adding the granting of a license fee to that equation.
Let me see what Ms. Pacnan has to say.
Thank you. It may be that this the fact that we are not authorized to charge a renewal fee, it may be that that was not intentional. We see unintended consequences of legislation all the time. So it may be that if the regulatory community raises this issue with the legislature, they may realize that this was somehow overlooked. And so this may be corrected at some point in the future, or corrected from our perspective anyway. So I do think we need to keep that in mind, that that may be something that it's not uncommon for new legislation, especially that which, you know, implements sweeping policy changes. It's very typical to come back in subsequent sessions and sort of tinker with it. So I just wanted to raise that. We may not be in this predicament forever.
Dr. Malat?
I think, you know, I just wanted to make the point that we were comparing, application fee, registration fee, the fact that it is there, are using a different word, does give us, I think, some latitude to assess a true cost. You know, they did not use the word application fee. They did not use the word when you were using a new word in a registration fee. The other thing that maybe we can do because is what are other states charging? And, you know, how close are we to the other states that will be charging a registration fee as well? And would that help?
Ms. Pacnan?
Madam Chair, Dr. Malat, unfortunately, we don't have any of that kind of data. I mean, it's to your point, that would be a great place to look, but this is really unique legislation. I think that over time, as with universal recognition, other states will follow in Arizona's footsteps and adopt, you know, this kind of a practice registry. Now that, of course, you know, telehealth has changed and advanced and evolved so dramatically out of, you know, necessity and driven by technology and best practices and so forth. We just don't have any data to look at elsewhere. It may be that other states are going to look at us because we were first.
Dr. Meyer, did you have additional comments?
I was just going to say what Dr. Malat said, that we can't both argue that application and registration are the same, but then also say it's apples and oranges and they're different. So either this is different or the same. But right. I say we just grab a number and move on.
Dr. Davey, your hand is still up. Did you have a comment, or I figure not. I wasn't ignoring you if you did, but.
No, I'm done. Sorry, I didn't take it down from the last time. My statements from last time still stand.
Dr. Gill.
Is it appropriate just to propose the existing rates, and then we collect data for the next time we were forced to make this decision? Would that be appropriate?
So, Dr. Gill, I believe that that's what's been proposed, but in two forms. So my proposal is $850. And Mr. Dinar points out that that in his interpretation, it would just be the application if we were to crosswalk it or attempt to crosswalk it that way would be the 350. Dr. Meyer brings up a good point that my 850 is assessing 2 years and not 1 year. And so perhaps 600 is the better number. But those are the three numbers that we essentially have before us for what we're currently doing, 350, 600, and 850. I think to Mr. Diner and Dr. Millett's point, perhaps, and maybe this is part of my concern as to why I do have a concern with having an exact number that references any of our other numbers, is that they are different and I don't want to give the perception that it's the same, because if we do have to change it when we do have data and we do have, you know, budget stuff, I don't want to give that perception. I do, on a personal level, I do think that very similar to what Universal Recognition has done, I do think that this incentivizes out of state and kind of in some ways punishes in-state applicants. And I don't see a way around that. The legislation itself, the cards we were dealt, I don't think that there's any way around that. I feel the same way about Universal Recognition, that in some ways it really discourages in-state applicants from staying in state and really encourages out-of-state people from coming in and what have you. But at the same time, I have spent many years trying to troubleshoot how to get those rural communities served. And I don't want to do something that is also, or has the appearance or could make it difficult for folks to come through, or has the appearance of being punitive because, hey, we have renewal fees and you don't, because I don't want to discourage people from going through the process if it means we can get access to service quicker to members. So it's an interesting dynamic. I would be interested to hear, and a part of it, I think, goes back to, you know, how long does the average application take? And maybe looking at a true cost of what it really takes to process something like that, both at application and maybe renewal, and add those together. But it's hard to, again, crosswalk that because we don't know what first party verifications are going to be necessary and what the application is going to look like. And all of the things that go into cost of our current application process may or may not apply to the registration process. So there's really not even a crosswalk. I think perhaps the proposal of $600 is a good starting point. It's a little bit lower than I would have liked to see, but I think it meets some of my other points. I think that Dr. Meyer had good points around that. And then just getting the data and saying, is this truly covering the cost of staff work? Which we won't know until we have the other answers.
So you're not proposing the 850, the 600 instead?
Well, yeah, I think, like I said, the 850 for me encompassed two years worth. Do I think that the cost would reflect 850 or 1,000? Yes. Do I think that that's reasonable? Yes. But am I willing to compromise given that there are other board members who are interpreting more of just the application fee, which is 350? I want more than 350, so I'm willing to compromise. And ultimately, it scares me to make too big of a decision without data. And in our current administration, which I know is subject to change, the reason why laws like this are getting passed is because we're an open for business state. They want accessibility. They want mobility. And anything that we do that might have the perception that we are discouraging that, we've already kind of gotten a little bit of a talking to about that. So I think we have to be cognizant of where the current administration stands on their intent of passing legislation like this.
Is that a motion? Are you going to make a motion? Do we need a motion?
I'm happy to turn that into a motion of $600 pending a review, and hopefully directing board staff to really capture how long it's taking them to process those applications and process that annual renewal when it comes about.
I'll second that, and I like the idea of a 1 year review of it.
So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Just one point, maybe on the application. I mean, is it prudent to put the asterisk on there that this is the current fee and that we reserve the right to modify that at any particular time? Like, do we need to be upfront about that? That there could be a change?
As government, I mean,
do we have to notice that?
You do not. You would have that authority. I believe right now the rulemaking process, you're exempt from the rulemaking process, Heidi, for 1 year. So any change that you make after 1 year, we would have to go through. Actually, you're exempt from fees. Anyway, never mind.
So what is that limited hold? What's that time frame where we have to revisit that? Because essentially, as soon as we set this, right, the clock starts ticking and we've got to start collecting data so that we can come back and make any adjustments within 364 days or something like that?
Madam Chair, I believe the 1 year period, the clock started when the legislation was signed, and because it had the emergency clause, it was in effect immediately. So that was May 5th. So we've got 11 months.
But Ms. Galvin said we're exempt from rulemaking for fee adjustments.
I'd have to go back and look at that. Heidi, I believe you are. We don't have to answer that today.
Okay.
Yeah, if we could get an answer on that, and then perhaps we revisit this in 10 months just in case. I don't think we'll have enough data, but maybe we'll have some projections based on who has registered. I think that would be a good start. Mr. Diner, you were going to say something. I know
Can I just follow up on that comment then to the data collection? Do we want to have a standing agenda item where we get an update on what the numbers of the registry are looking like so that we can discuss at any point versus...
Well, we will know that when we approve application. You know, they'll be on the list for approvals every month. Yes. So
you can say that approval committee would then note that we need to have this as an agenda item?
Madam Chair, I'd love to address that. What I am anticipating with the new system, once it's launched, which as I mentioned in my ED report, the new target date is August 15th. I want to create a dashboard so that every month this board and the CBA have a reporting of certain data points that you want us to track and you want to evaluate on a continual basis. So this, to me, fits very nicely on that dashboard. We don't have the technology to do that now on the Salesforce platform, but the Open Regulate system will give us what I'm looking for.
Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was going to be, when we revisit this issue in 1 year, I think Ms. Galvin sort of hinted at what the problem is. We would be outside the period of the exempt rulemaking. So we would need to get the governor's permission to do a rule change at that point. So that was going to be my comment. And I think we already addressed some of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. And with that, Ms. Galvin will look at the possible window that we have outside of that and get back to us maybe at the next meeting. But maybe we put it on the agenda for 10 months from now and see if we can come up with some better projections than, again, kind of the arbitrary basis that we're trying to move forward with now. But I agree. Going through the rule writing to get the change may present its own problems as well. So we do have a motion and a second. We've had discussion. Do you need a roll call vote, Ms. Galvin?
Not a roll call vote.
Okay, perfect. Then all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
Diner opposes.
All right, we have, 6 6 yeses and 1 no, so the motion does carry.
I do not see Ms. LaBoy on the line.
No, and I don't have a note from her that she had to leave.
So 6-1.
Yes.
No, 7.
7-1. Yep. Dr. Malott. Make 7. All right. Thank you. We will move along.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the next CE code word for the meeting. The next CE code word is summer school. Summer school.
Right. Thank you.
Just 2.
If we could, I would like to maybe see item number 17, because it's quick. It'll go quick, and then I'd like to see what the board would like to do about maybe another break before we proceed with the last 2 items. So item number 17 is the discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding behavior analyst application for licensure, Melissa Marie Michaela. I am the lead for this application, so I will summarize it for the board. Melissa passed her exam in December of 2022. She was a certified special education teacher in good standing. She completed her master's from Northern Arizona University in special education, the graduate certificate in positive behavior support. She did complete 1,500 hours of supervision between the periods of 2018 and 2019 across 2 licensed and approved supervisors here in Arizona. I have reviewed her application. I do not see any concerns with that, and I would move for it to be approved.
So moved.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Our last 2 agenda items are pertaining to board staff and discussion of performance. Do we want to just take a comfort break, or are folks in need of a little bit longer to grab some food? Comfort break?
I would like to do a shorter break.
Okay. Then perhaps maybe coming back at 12:45. So that gives everybody about 7 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Diner, you're back?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. And Dr. Malott?
I'm here. I never left.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, we can proceed. I did accidentally overlook agenda item number 14. So if we could do that one real quick. Agenda item 14, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding licensure and regulatory issues related to COVID-19. Ms. Pacanon, can you please provide us an overview?
Yes, Madam Chair. So June 1st was the deadline to report to the governor's office which of the administrative rule waivers and suspensions that boards had put into place due to COVID-19. We were to report by June 1 the recommendations that you all arrived at, or that this board arrived at, relative to, you know, keeping them in place or allowing them to terminate with the termination of the order. So because that was so recent, I don't have any sort of response or any feedback to our submission. I do believe that there is some discussion that on June 14th, the directors of the regulatory boards, the 90-10 boards, that we will have someone from the governor's office at that meeting to sort of, you know, address any questions that we have relative to, you know, timing of the lifting of the state of emergency and, you know, what the implications are for us, you know, just so we have our plans in place, we can execute them, ideally maybe having, you know, some notice about them and so forth. So if that is indeed the case, I'm working to confirm that we will be having that discussion on June 14th. I'm very hopeful that we will, because I think that you know, we all sort of need to get on the same page so that there isn't a whole lot of, you know, confusion that ensues when this happens, and, you know, a lot of questions and phone calls and emails to respond to. So I'm hoping this can be as coordinated as it possibly can be. So that's all I have by way of an update on that topic.
Thank you. We will now move to agenda item 15. The board may vote to go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A1 to review personnel matters and our ARS 38431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. The board determined during the May 7th meeting that it is appropriate time to conduct a performance appraisal of the executive director using the statewide appraisal tool. I move the board move into executive session to discuss personnel matters. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Madam Chairman, members of the board, do you want Ms. Pekkanen at this time? Do you have questions of her, or do you want to discuss the appraisal tool separately?
Let's start with the appraisal tool without Ms. Pekkanen, and then we will bring her in.
Okay, so I can take minutes during this part of the executive session. So only the board members and myself would be brought in.
Thank you. I think everybody is back now. So we do need to make a motion. And I, Ms. Shreve, do you
want me to make the motion? I would motion that based upon the discussion in executive session and the high quality of work that we feel Ms. Pekkanen is doing and her very excellent performance, that we approve the salary that was discussed in executive session.
And okay, I have seconds.
Any further discussion? I just wanted to reiterate for the record, Ms. Shreve said it, but Ms. Pekkanen, thank you again for all of your hard work, because this has been a trying by the reins, and have totally made a rock star of yourself. And again, the growth of this board has been astronomical. So thank you very much for that. Any additional discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to see where we go from here. So I'm glad we're all on this together.
Thank you. All right, we will move to agenda item number 16. Ms. Pekkanen, would you please provide a summary of this matter to the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the state personnel rules and the guidelines that have been adopted by the Arizona Department of Administration include a provision that merit-based incentives can be awarded to board staff based on a specific set of criteria and a formula, which I have outlined in the memo. What I have determined is that we do meet this criteria, and staff would be eligible for merit-based incentives. We have a lump sum by formula of about $3,200 with which to work. And what I understand to have been the precedent for this is that my predecessor's predecessor had requested board authorization to grant me the discretion to award merit-based incentives from that lump sum. So that is the request that I'm presenting. If the board disagrees or does not approve of this particular strategy, All that means is that this amount of money will not be spent and it will revert back into the board's fund at the end of the fiscal year. Any questions that I can answer or clarifications?
Are there any questions from Ms. Pacman?
I just had one question for Ms. Pacman. I was reading the chart that you provided. Is there any requirement of this bell-shaped curve, or are you able to do a flat amount?
Madam Chair, thank you for asking that question, Dr. Mala. I had to read that multiple times and get clarification myself that because we're an agency with fewer than 10 employees, we are exempt from that.
Oh, good.
Yes. So, and that does make sense. I would imagine for a large agency, the bell curve would be, a necessary approach. But with an agency this small, that would be a challenging exercise for us. So,
Thank you. I just didn't want something to come back from the state.
Right. Thank you.
So I'll make a motion that we approve the merit-based incentive pay for board staff, as outlined by Ms. Pacanon.
Second.
I'll second.
I think we all second.
Give a motion.
If, open, if it's all seconded.
And again, that motion, just to clarify, is to provide Ms. Pacanon the authority to spend that available funding as she sees fit. Any further discussion? I just want to add, again, for the record, the board staff has had a long year and has gone above and beyond to make sure that we have all of our meetings prepared. They have worked late nights, they have worked long weeks, they have worked weekends. So again, to reiterate our appreciation, thank you so much to board staff for all that you do. We see you, we know the work that you guys are doing, and we greatly appreciate your time and your commitment to this board. All right, any other discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. And thank you, Heidi, for bringing this to our attention and advocating for the use of those funds. And once again, the very thorough explanation.
Very welcome.
Mo, that you provided us. All right, we are on agenda item number 18. Do we have any items for future meetings? I know we talked about a couple throughout the meeting, but any additional?
Madam Chair, may I?
Mr. Steiner.
Thank you. So I wonder if we should make it like a standing agenda item. It's there on the agenda. It's item number 5, the council update. But I know there's that suit filed against the board that's going on. And as things develop in the suit, I would like to see the materials that are filed in the court be provided to all of the board members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. That will be noted. Ms. Shreve?
Can I just confirm? Someone said there wasn't a meeting in July. I thought there was. Is there a meeting in July?
Yeah, there is. July
9th.
Okay.
Oh, really? Oh, missed that. Okay.
All right.
Once upon a time, we could get away with not doing a July meeting, but we're not in those times right now.
Yeah, I did have that. Sorry.
Madam Chair, I do have a question I've been meaning to ask for some time, and it seems appropriate to do it now. I have, of course, an executive director's report, and I trust you all, cling to every word that I write, but the PT board preferred that the report be not on the consent agenda because they wanted to at times discuss items and ask questions, especially if I was, less than clear about anything or of that nature. So I know historically this report has been on the consent agenda. And so when I joined the board, I just followed tradition. But if the board prefers, we can have it as a separate agenda item, which, affords opportunity for discussion. But if you're happy with the report where it is, I'm happy to continue on with the tradition. I just thought I would raise the question.
Are we able to answer that question, or do we have to add it to an agenda to discuss?
I think you can just give her direction.
Okay.
My preference is to keep it as it is. If there's questions, we can pull it off consent.
Yeah. Dr. Malat?
No, I was going to say the opposite, but you know, it's nice to hear from Ms. Packinen as well. So, and maybe highlight, if it's a long report, just a couple of things, you know, and then so. But I'll defer to the, you know, the board as well, because meetings can get very long too. So
I think that's the kicker, right? Like, the meeting materials can be long, and as a new board member, hearing things in the meetings, because I might read it. I'm not new anymore, but it still sometimes feels like I'm new. But hearing things, you can read it, but then when you hear it, you might get a little bit of a different perspective on something. With that being said, the meetings have been so long. I don't know if you guys remember, we used to have one meeting that was quarterly that would run all day. And then the other 2 months were, you know, it would be like, 1 month was all day, and then we'd have a month or two of like 2 hour meetings over the phone and then be done. And so I do have concerns about the length of the meetings, and perhaps what we could do is maybe add this, you know, maybe circle back to this in a few months. And if the meetings have, I like Dr. Malat, I like to hear those things. But I do think that the meeting agendas have just been extremely hefty, and that might add unnecessary time to the meeting. So perhaps it's something we could circle back to.
I say we circle back in about 4 months and see, because these meetings are long. They never used to be this long, and they
never used to be.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering, is there a plan for format for this meeting in the future? I know that's something we are all discussing at our different workplaces.
What do you mean by going back in person?
I'm just wondering what the plan is. Is there a plan? Is it always going to, you know?
That could be on the next agenda, that we have this discussion about what the future may look like in terms of meeting format. There are, in doing so, we can include, you know, the budget implications and that sort of thing.
And the scheduling, right? Because at least with the Zoom, we don't have the scheduling conflicts that we were running into with the in-person too. But yeah, I would love to have a discussion on that. All right.
I would think proactively, Heidi, like when you think about our conference room that we would go back to, is having the ability to have a large screen with Zoom up live with our colleagues that are either, one, not comfortable coming back, or to be able to facilitate improved participation. Because I think, you know, as much as we all have Zoom fatigue, it's going to stick. People are enjoying, I think is a strong word, but people are using the technology. So we may want to think about having, you know, a large screen TV up there with that kind of capability, particularly as we look to transition back.
And I think that is a great item for future discussions, because if we do go back, I mean, I'm appreciating not traveling.
Right.
So
that's kind of how, yeah. So I think there's pros and cons, definitely. I miss snacks, though.
Yeah, but we lost our rum cake, so, you know,
I miss
downhill from there on.
I miss the rum cake. I miss the snacks. I miss seeing people, but I'm not going to lie. 7 months home has been also very nice. So yeah. I have not had to. I left her one time. I did some work. Like the Friday before last, and that's the first time that I've left the house without her for more than like 2 hours. So not gonna lie, it's been nice being at home.
Bonded.
Right. Yeah, yep. Right. And now I've got a beast that won't even sit with anybody else but me, right? All right. Any additional meeting items? All right, hearing none, we can move to agenda item 19. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
I motion to adjourn.
Okay.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All right. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.